Happy Monday, folks. That's when this will actually be released, and usually you'd be hearing Buffalo Rodeo and their song All the Same, and you will. But before we started, we felt like the appropriate course of action, and we're not going to belabor this point because 24-hour news services and every newspaper in the country, the AP Newswire, everybody has an opinion on the Aurora shootings, or everybody wants all the news. There are plenty of outlets with which to get that. We are starting with a moment of silence, which is going to follow my comments here, and that is going to be for the victims and for their families and for those affected with what happened in Aurora. And quite frankly, on behalf of Andy and certainly of myself, we just feel like that is where people's minds need to be. That's where their thoughts need to be. And I think that the people who lost their lives trying to see a movie that I'm sure they were anticipating for weeks and counting down the days to, just like we were, I think that they would want to hear the conversation that we're going to have today about the film and about the trilogy and about just Batman in general and how it, what it means to us and what I'm sure it meant to them for them to have gone out at midnight and tried to watch this film before this horrific tragedy happened. So this show is dedicated to those who lost their lives or were wounded in what happened in Aurora, Colorado, just about 30 hours ago. One of the most tragic and shocking experiences that any of us have ever seen, will ever see. We can't begin to imagine what the families are going through and what these people went through who lost their lives in the last seconds of their lives. So we're going to take 10 seconds now and just have a quick moment of silence for those who lost their lives. And we'll be back with today's edition of Certifiable Total Recall in just a couple of seconds. Happy Monday, folks. Andrew Van on the other end of the line from down in Simpsonville, South Carolina. My name is Jason Martin. I am, of course, in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and this is the one and only undefeated Certifiable Total Recall podcast. We're actually recording this on Saturday night. You'll be hearing it at least beginning on Monday morning. Hopefully your week has started out extremely well, and ours has for a number of reasons, which we'll get to in our main topic, because the one thing that we have agreed on since day one is our just intense love and affection for the Batman universe, and we're going to have a great time talking about that here today. But of course, a lot of things going on in the world. Andy, what is up, my friend?
What ticket?
Oh, what is happening?
I come from the land down under. Yeah, that's right. That's the only words I know to that song, by the way, so don't expect too much from that. It is July 21st, 2012. Happy post-Batman Day to you, sir.
You as well.
Yep. On a positive note, lots of things going on in the world, lots of things going on here. NCAA Foosball 13 came out. So I'm very surprised. I'm not surprised, yet I am, at the same time, that you decided in our dynasty to go with WKU. I thought you would go with your old alma mater just to stay in the ACC with me, but I guess I was disappointed. And I didn't know whether or not to make custom schedules so you and me would play each other or not, but I guess we'll see how our fates end.
Yep, NCAA is out, and I was not going to purchase it, and I rented it the first day before heading down to Nashville for my internship. And just thought I'd play for 5 days to scratch the itch until Madden came out. And then when I turned on the game and saw Smith Stadium here in Bowling Green and saw the Mass Media Hall and saw our water tower in the background and saw the Russell Athletic store in the stadium replicated in the game and our championship effort banners, as well as correct uniforms, correct captains, and a perfectly rendered version of our stadium, that really caught me off guard. And I thought, well, if I can find this for at least a mild discount, I might actually get it. And Toys R Us for the first week was selling this game for $44. So I picked it up and felt like, because I'm going to be doing a lot of college football, some things that I'll talk about in a couple of weeks, plus doing the high school play-by-play and everything, this game could kind of be research for me, because with what I have to do with the WKU athletic department, both on TV and radio, it'll help me remember, you know, just kind of remind myself of the players and the numbers and all those kinds of things right in front of me, and just kind of be able to use these guys and go through the schedule and learn everything through the rosters and all. So I felt like it was kind of half and half. I'm doing it for pleasure, but I'm also doing it for work and the benefit of some of the things I'm going to be doing. There's not a tremendous amount that I noticed that was different in terms of the gameplay, except that we both liked last year's. The reason it didn't work out is because of the crippling glitch that made a lot of games not count and basically just froze you out of Online Dynasty. That's what it was. It had nothing to do with the quality of game last year. I think the graphics engine at some point needs to be overhauled. Madden is using the brand new Infinity engine this year. But NCAA is still a really fun game of football, and I haven't gotten to play very much of it yet. But, yeah, I picked WKU because that's where a lot of my successes have come from. What happened at NC State after the first semester is not just not something that I can look back on as fondly as what's going on here. Plus, since I'm here again, being able to play the schedule of the things that I'll be covering from a journalistic perspective this fall, it just seemed to make more sense.
Here's the thing, too, is I would agree with you on some of the graphics overhaul. It's actually a little bit better tweaked, especially with the replays, by the way. What I like especially is the Dynasty modes, where it recaps, like, you know, Reese Davis in the booth talking about, like, other current games going on. And also the Heisman campaigns are really fun. Right now I'm actually playing the Herschel Walker one.
Mm-hmm.
So you gotta like match or break his records within the year to get your Heisman for him. And it's weird because you're playing as Herschel Walker, and they make the character model as best as they can to look like him, but you're playing with the current team and the current schedule. So that's a little odd. But long story short, with his campaign, I've reached 1,200 yards in three games, and he is only needed 1,700 yards and a couple of TDs, and I'll be good to go. But anyway, that to me was really fun about it, and I'll probably do the Doug Flutie one next, just because Doug Flutie, it's interesting to me how a guy so short was so skilled back then and then became a punter for the New England Patriots in the end of his career. Anyway, but I like it, and I'm definitely looking forward to Madden, so this is definitely hold me over until then. What else is going on? I am currently reading, like a big boy, the Spider-Man story arc from Marvel.
Proud of you.
Have you started reading that yet?
No. Like I said, I have the first three.
So why are you
but
proud
of me? I haven't had a chance. Well, I'm just proud of you that you're reading comics again.
Oh, well, I haven't bought an actual comic in a long time because I'm just so sick and tired of just the stupid hypocrisy and stupid takesy-backsies of the way Marvel and DC work. It's like, you're going to get like overhyped with this campaign ad for this huge event, like Civil War or, you know, Green Lantern Corps or whatever, or the Black Hand, stuff like that, or Rest in Peace, Batman. But then they just, like, a few months later, oh, you know what? That was a shitty idea. We're going to re-scrap the whole thing. Or in DC's case, reboot the whole entire damn series for everybody.
Right.
So I try not to get invested with major story arcs anymore. Spider-Man was really interesting to me when I first heard about it, because I thought initially it's cheesy because, yes, in the Ultimate Spider-Man series, Peter Parker, who's younger, died recently at the hands of Green Goblin, and a 12- or 13-year-old kid, Miles Morales, took over due to similar flaws with a spider bite that was leaked out from a lab, blah, 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 on a tour when he was visiting Peter Parker. And then Nick Fury takes him in and trains him to be the new Spider-Man for the world. But it's interesting to me because it really dives into the character flaws of both characters. At the same time, you get like a deeper sense of Spider-Man and like what he does and why he does it, and basically his just whole idealism of like being a symbol, because like it's portrayed in many comics and shows and movies where basically he's a vigilante, kind of like Batman, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, soon enough. But he's a vigilante to most, but a symbol to the rest of hope and of good. And in the Ultimate series, when he died, everybody found out who he was.
Right.
He was fighting with the mask. He fought to the death to protect his friends and family, his loved ones, in front of a crowd, in front of people, and it was all over the media news in that world. And so it's interesting when Peter Parker from the Marvel Universe goes into the Ultimate Universe, they see this like guy just like Spider-Man. Everyone's offended and pissed off, and they're like, why would you do something like that? That's just – you know what you're doing? You can get shot, man. And he's like, what are you talking about? Like, has no idea what's going on. And it's kind of humbling to him. And as a reader, it's really humbling because, like, you kind of feel like you're part of this world too, because you're like – you get it. You love Spider-Man because you're reading this. So you feel like in this world, they love Spider-Man because he gave up his life for these people. And there are times where he breaks down emotionally, realizing what happened in this world to his alternate self, and it's just really it's emotional to read, and it's good. And I just wrapped up 3 out of 5. 4 comes out on, I believe, August 8th, so I'm very looking forward to that. And then when it ends soon, definitely keep those for a while. So Spider-Man, go get it.
Yeah, well, I agree. In general, with your comment, like I said, I haven't read these yet, but I'll get to them in the next few days. Now you've got me a little bit more excited to jump back into it. I do suggest and humbly recommend that you read Scott Snyder's first 10, 11 Batman rebooted comics from the New 52. Scott Snyder, first of all, is an incredible rising name in comics. He's been around for a while, but his American Vampire series, I think, won the Eisner, but if not, it was in the running for Best New Series, and it's just an incredibly good comic. But Snyder's done some really good stuff with Batman. Not going to go into it anymore. Maybe we'll do it on a future episode at some point, but go read Night of the Owls and some of the stuff that's come out in these first 11 issues. I know the first trade is already out, but they are well worth reading. A lot of the New 52 stuff is garbage. Batman is not one of them, which is obviously good if you're me or you. But as you were mentioning Spider-Man, the last time we talked, The Amazing Spider-Man had not yet released. So it would be kind of ridiculous for us to overlook what I thought was a fabulous reboot of that franchise, and a film that made Spider-Man 3 look even worse, as if that was possible, than what it looked like 3 years ago when it released, or 6 years, 5 years ago, whenever it was when it released.
Randy will probably never admit this, but to those who hated the movie, and you should feel and know somewhere that I feel that Raimi sold out to Sony Pictures, because he claimed when he was making the first Spider-Man back in 2001, 2002, that he was a huge diehard fan. He was going to do justice, which he did. I believe the first two Spider-Man movies are – it's hard for me to jump to say that Amazing Spider-Man is better than the first two now, because I'm still in that prison moment where I absolutely adored Amazing Spider-Man. But I wanted to soak in for a few weeks so I can judge it and just kind of reflect on it with more time soaked in. But – yeah, I agree full-heartedly that 3 looks like shambles now, more so than it did before, because I feel like Raimi sold out. He basically – I'm sure he had some kind of idea, but then some producers or something like that or whatever got to him and was like, you know what? We should do this. We should do this. This is what this should look like. Oh, let's add this. And it just – it didn't feel right at all watching that movie. Like, there was just so much crap in that movie. There was Gwen Stacy, which really had no impact. There was emo Spider-Man. There was a shitty black symbiote suit that was just basically the same fucking suit, but just grayscaled on Photoshop.
There was a Saturday Night Live John Travolta ripoff Tobey Maguire scene.
Yeah.
Which I don't even know what to say about that. The other thing that I think was different between The Amazing Spider-Man and at least the third Spider-Man, well, no, I would say this overall. Casting in terms of chemistry, this one blows the old cast out of the water, but one of the main reasons why, I think, is because Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield and Rhys Ifans and all the people associated with this new reboot wanted to be a part of this. They want to do this. They have a little bit of passion for it, a little bit of love for it. And it always felt like to me that even Toby, but particularly Kirsten, just thought they were too good for a superhero film. And as a result, a lot of times the passion and the emotion between those characters didn't show up on screen to the level that I think it did with Garfield and Stone, who I thought were matched beautifully. And every time they were on screen, you could just feel the passion between those two characters and the chemistry. And that really, really benefited the rebooted Spider-Man. And even the bit roles, I mean, Dennis Leary in particular was very good.
Absolutely.
And obviously Sally Field and Martin Sheen and all that. But suffice to say, we're not going to spend too much on it, but if you haven't seen it, you need to see it. It's very good. And the people that are like, well, why are you going to do another origin story? Well, because Spider-Man 3 was so toxic that you had to establish a new universe and a new identity for all the new actors so that they could get away from just how abysmally horrific the last effort was by Sam Raimi and those guys.
But the only thing, too, is you got to do another reboot, especially if it's a whole other series. But at the same time, not everyone's going to see the Raimi ones. Not everyone's going to see the things that most people have seen in theaters already or DVD, whatever. So, yeah, this is basically it's a new take. It's a little different. I like – that's the thing that I like about the first Spider-Man more on Raimi's thing is that he did more – the origin story that was more true than this version, which I'm not knocking this version by any means. It was still done well. It's just I like that it was closer to the comics in the first one with Tobey Maguire back, you know, 10 years ago than this one.
And clearly Garfield is more like Peter Parker.
Absolutely. The one of my favorite lines is just that one line when he first busts up in the suit and it's the whole, you got me. You found my weakness.
Small knives.
And yeah. he's fucking with the guy so bad. By the way, we're explicit. And he's just shooting all those webs around just to mess with him. And it's just beautifully well done. I would think, too, if he wanted to, let's say, well, I doubt it because they definitely are going to make more movies. He could definitely pass for a Deadpool if he had some weight on him. But, you know, whatever. We'll see what Ryan Reynolds wants to do with that, if they ever do that.
Yeah.
But the smart-ass Spider-Man was so good because that's what he is, man. That's exactly. That's what's fun to read about Spider-Man. That's what I miss about Spider-Man until I started reading these Spider-Men. It's just like there's a part where basically the Marvel Universe Spider-Man meets Nick Fury of the Ultimate Series, who is basically Samuel Jackson, which is the one that's in the movies. And he's like, wait, what? Like looking at him like, no. And this is long rant of like basically – what he's sitting in, and he's freaking out, and basically like, long story short, he's like, you're much cooler, Nick Fury. And I was like, yeah, he's saying what the people think. Now, granted, according to David Hasselhoff, he played a better Nick Fury, but whatever, we'll let that be.
Yeah, maybe. We will indeed let that be.
Aw.
I have nothing to say about David Hasselhoff's clarifications on Spider-Man acting participation. There are some things going on. USA series just came back, all of them that I absolutely love. Suits in particular has really just taken off the second season. They're breaking the mold of USA shows in terms of each one self-contained with just a little bit extra, where they used to have the rule of the 80-20 split between what you can do that is individual so that they can run it into syndication and the 20% of congruent story stuff. Suits feels like it's a continuing story week to week in a way that other series on that network have never done. They're starting to do that with Covert Affairs also, but Suits is just a fantastic show, start to finish, top to bottom. That's a show everybody should be watching. Of course, AMC just brought back Breaking Bad for its final season, even though they're just running the first half of it. First episode was outrageously good. I assume that the next seven will continue that trend. That's the best show on TV, not named Mad Men. And the difference between one and two is not that great. So there's a lot to like right there. Been playing Saints Row the Third just a little bit this week. I had gotten it a long time ago and just hadn't started to play it. Man, I got to tell you, Andy, that game's fun as hell.
Yeah, because there's no ambition. There's no
so
real storyline. Just fucking go nuts in that game.
It's
who the hell you
so
play?
Fun. And just like, it's hilarious. The dialogue is just flat funny. And the idea that, you know, these gangsters are heroes, and like people are taking pictures of them everywhere they go while they're committing crimes. And like they have this banter where they sign autographs and then they, you know, go off onto these violent sprees and all these kinds of things. It's just it doesn't take itself seriously at all. It's fun. The graphics are good. I haven't run any kind of lag issues or slowdown or anything like that. It's just really fun game to play. if you haven't gotten a chance to play that, I highly urge you do so. Tony Hawk Pro Skater HD released this week as well on Xbox Live.
Seeing good reviews.
Yes, I think it got to PSN last week. I bought it because I love that series. The old ones, not anything since Underground 2, I really haven't. I think American Wasteland was probably okay, but I stopped at Tony Hawk's Underground 2. There are some issues. The controls don't feel quite as tight as maybe they should. There should probably be more levels, and I'm sure they'll dole those out. I know they're putting out 3 or 4 levels from Tony Hawk 3 in a month that are going to go on there. There's a couple things they need to do, but it's still Tony Hawk if you like that fun, arcadey style. So, there you go. All right.
It's not downhill racing?
Yeah, no, it's not Downhill Jam. There is a Downhill Jam level in it, though.
Did they include a fake hoverboard in this one?
No. That you can still get if you want to buy the ride or
ride the snake.
All right. So, before we get to the topic at hand, I wanted to talk about my experiences before walking into the theater. Because Thursday in Nashville, obviously I did my intern thing and I stayed at the studio until about 8 p.m. Because they had scheduled Spider-Man at, I guess, 10:30 or something when the tickets were first put on sale 6 weeks ago for the IMAX, the show did not run until 1:21 a.m. And they ended up canceling Spider-Man because they realized they had made a mistake, but everybody had already bought tickets, so it's not like they could just change the time because they couldn't assume everybody would know that the time changed, even if they sent out emails to everybody that bought tickets on Fandango. They couldn't take that risk. So there was no midnight IMAX in Nashville in the third biggest theater in the country, or the third biggest screen in the country, and I think the best sound system in the country. The first one was 1:21. So I had time to kill, so I went to Opry Mills, which I had never been to, and really nice mall. There's like a restaurant that has an aquarium in it where it feels like you're underwater while you eat. Didn't go there. There is a place that I went to, though, that I think Andy probably has been to before somewhere else in the country that's franchised and everything else that I had just never gone to before, for not really because I didn't want to, just because just never had been in a place where people were going there. I went to Dave and Buster's to kill some time, just to eat. I'm not interested in all the games and all that stuff. Dave and Buster's could potentially be the most overrated, overpriced food in the history of the universe.
Yeah.
The food was about $13 for just like a basic chicken tenders thing, which is all I was prepared to try. And they said it was like legendary on the menu. It's like all famous and all this kind of stuff's from their originals and all this. I get these things. It's like just a small little cup of fries and 5 chicken tenders, and it was $15. And that's with a water. I was just like, are you kidding me? I was eating here so I wouldn't eat popcorn at the movie because I knew it was going to be overpriced. And come to find out, I still ended up spending $15 even without a water. Then I walk into the theater and see that this place had undergone $13 million in renovations from when Opry Mills shut down after the floods in Nashville a few years ago. And they had a full menu. I mean, chicken sandwiches, subs, wraps, jalapeno poppers, fries, onion rings, pizza, all of it at the concession stand for cheaper prices than what Dave & Buster's was selling their menu for. They also, by the way, sell beer at this theater. And it was selling all night long, 24 hours a day. And I'm not talking about like just Budweiser. I'm talking about Blue Moon and Amstel and I think Shock Top and different bottles and all kinds of stuff like this. This was the most intelligent concession stand I've ever seen. But my point to mention this before we got to the main topic was just so I can say what's the appeal about Dave & Buster's, because I was not impressed at all. Then I walked around the game thing, and 70% of the stuff isn't like, you know, your big-time arcade games or classic stuff that people would care about. It's all these, I don't know, trivia and all this other kind of stuff that's just designed to get you to keep putting money in to get tickets to go to this prize vault, which I looked at, which is just horrifically lame. And there were just people all over the place doing this, and it just didn't make sense. Now, the bowling alley, I might have taken advantage of that just to have a little time, a little fun, but I didn't feel like doing it that night. But it seemed to me like this place way overrated from what people have told me over the years.
And that has been J Mart's What the Fuck.
Yeah, there you go. That's my WTF of the week.
By the way, before we go to the next topic, we mentioned the Emmys real quick. Why the fuck is Danny Pudi not, again, nominated for anything? Please tell me why Danny Pudi is always snubbed.
Yeah, well, at least Community did get a writing nod for the name of the episode. Escapes me right now, but the different realities, the pizza episode.
Multiverse?
But what was it called? It was like Chaos Theory, Strategic Chaos, Remedial Chaos Theory.
Something like that.
Yeah, it was nominated for an Emmy for writing.
I just don't understand. Okay, Louis deserves to be up there. Absolutely. Don Cheadle, I'm sure, deserves to be up there. You like House of Lies.
Yep.
Larry David's kind of iffy to me. Jim Parsons is always up there. That's just kind of like – to me, Jim Parsons now is the Tony Shalhoub of that category.
Yeah.
He's just going to be there, and he's going to win most likely.
I think Louis is going to win this year, but
– but Alec Baldwin and Larry David, though?
Larry David, I can still understand. Alec Baldwin does the same thing over and over again, and 30 Rock's ratings dropped like 30% this season. And it's got half a season left, and that means that Danny's never going to get an Emmy nomination. And that Abed character is so difficult to play because it requires pinpoint accuracy on incredibly fast dialogue of specific pop culture references, in the same way that Jim Parsons has to perform the Sheldon Cooper character with a bunch of fast dialogue about science. Danny Pudi has to act like basically an antisocial nutcase talking about pop culture, and does so well that every time I see Danny Pudi, I can't ever see anything but Abed in front of me. And that character deserves a hell of a lot more than it's gotten. You're absolutely right.
I don't know. Just that upsets me. But anyway, let's just let that go before we rant on that one. I'm sure we could for a long, long, long time in his respect. But topic at hand, shark repellent in Batman, The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, shark repellent bat spray. So good. Not gonna play Linda Richmond for you tonight, but I guess you get that instead. You can hear it in the background right now. That is my main man, Andy's main man, Hans Zimmer.
The
crushing it.
Man.
That is from the Dark Knight Rises soundtrack, which of course I bought. Cannot get enough of these soundtracks, and I think this one is the best of all because of a 3-track stretch between, I think it's track 9 through 11, where Hans takes a lot of the best moments of the scores up to that point and puts them into one conglomeration together. And it's just, you finally get to hear more extended variations on the parts of the songs that you really like the best. And it's just so good. And if you just buy the CD, which is what I did, it's $9.99, I think, most everywhere, you get access to 3 extra tracks, one of which is 8 minutes long from the film. And you get this decal, which works on both sides of a window, that is the chalk bat drawing that's used in The Dark Knight Rises, which could go on, you know, a window at home, and it would show on both sides, or you could put it on the inside of your car where nobody would take it or mess it up, and you would just have a chalk bat against your back window. And even though I haven't put a sticker on my car in years, I'm going to have to fight really hard not to put this on my car. Seriously.
All right.
I'm sure I'll succeed, but because it'll overwhelm me that I could just have this decal forever not messed up and just have it in the case with the CD is part of the collection. But all right, so that's Hans Zimmer. So we're going to talk about Superman. Well, no, we aren't.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
no, actually, we are.
I made you watch the teaser a little bit ago, so yeah, we are going to talk about that. So for those who most likely watched The Dark Knight Rises, you saw the Man of Steel trailer. Now, there are going to be those people who always hate Superman because he's too powerful. He's too strong. He's got too many abilities. He's not like Batman. Batman's just a regular dude. He
sounds like French Stewart. Ollie Parker and the Beaver Brown Band.
But I don't care. You know, I love Batman as much as anybody else, and I like Batman more as a whole character overall than Superman by a thread. But I love Superman, and I like his character, and for many reasons you and me can go on and on. They're different, but at the same time, they stand for the same thing, obviously, justice and all that. But from what you saw of the trailer, you go first, what do you think of the Man of Steel teaser?
Well, the way you framed it, I'm going to clarify why I didn't see the teaser before The Dark Knight Rises. If you see it in a true IMAX theater, the more full-on IMAX, like what happens in, I know the one that you saw in Simpsonville, and the one that happens, there's another one in Nashville at Indian Lake, which is the one I had gone to until this movie. They're just expanded screens with louder stuff, and I mean, the screens are bigger and they're widescreen, but this is a screen that literally goes from floor to ceiling and all the way left to right against the wall. The entire front wall is a screen. And it's a screen that has that is capable of producing two images at the same time, overlapping each other to add more depth of field to non-3D prints, and then has sound that goes from behind that wall all the way around, like 41 individual speakers and everything around in a circle. But most of the films, I've only seen two in a theater like this. The other one was in Charlotte, and that was in the more planetarium style where stuff's on the ceiling too. And that's kind of harder to see. Yeah, exactly. That's kind of harder to see than this was. This was the greatest movie experience I've ever had, just from that perspective alone, the way that you got to see it. But for the 30 minutes leading into the film, the Hans Zimmer soundtrack was playing. And then at 1:21, when the film was about to start, the lights went down and there was a 30-second soundtrack thing that played that just kind of gets you excited and everybody applauded and everything. And then all of a sudden you see the miniature city with the WB logo forming over the top of it. And it went directly into the film. So there were no previews, even though I knew the Man of Steel trailer was going to debut with The Dark Knight Rises. I also realized as soon as I walked into the theater, we weren't going to get to see it. So I've seen The Dark Knight Rises twice.
Okay. You went to the IMAX. Good for you.
So there you go. No, it's not that. I'm just saying I didn't get to see the trailer, but the trailer feels...
Why did I say you were poor?
Trailer feels like... Yeah, shut up. The trailer feels... The trailer feels like Batman Begins to me. I already kind of wondered that because I'd seen the poster, of course, many times in theaters and just, you know, on the internet. And the kind of the font that they use and the spacing between the letters still kind of has more of a Batman Dark Knight kind of feel to it, even though Nolan's just producing the Man of Steel and it's Zack Snyder that's directing it. But just the tone in terms of this does not look like a superhero trailer, except in the moment when you see Superman fire off into space. Basically, it just shows kind of a regular guy, but somebody that's obviously strong who's trying to find himself in the same way that it felt like Bruce Wayne was trying to do at the beginning of Batman Begins, when he gets trained by the League of Shadows and Ra's al Ghul, and at that time, Henry Ducard. So, to me, that's what I got out of it. By the end of it, when the S logo popped up, I could have seen a Bat logo pop up. It looked almost the same to me, and that immediately got me really excited that they're taking this really seriously. And another point that you've made before, and it was the same thing I was thinking when I saw it, I'm going to let you make the point, but Lex Luthor is another reason I really like this trailer.
Yeah, he's nowhere I've seen in this thing or right. In IMDb or anything. Now, granted, we don't know that yet. This may be something that they're hiding, that they're not saying who it is. Because, we'll get to it soon enough, in Dark Knight Rises, there's obviously a few surprises that were really, really fucking tight-lipped that came out while you watched the movie, and you're like, holy hell, and that's awesome. But, yeah, this movie, it's too early to tell. Won't come out until next summer. But from what I've seen, I'm very glad there's no Lex Luthor because, for fuck's sake, he's in every single Superman movie, and it's been awful. Thank you, Gene Hackman, for those. Anyway, but that's the thing I think that people miss out on Superman movies because the past three, including this past one, Batman movies have been doing very well, and they've gone and dwelled on good characters, and they've flourished them out very well, fleshed them out, that it saddens me that in all the Superman movies, they've only focused on one villain the entire time, except for in two we have Zod, and then you have his cronies, and then in three you had Richard Pryor with Lex Luthor, and then four you had fucking the radioactive man from the moon that made no sense with fingernails, claws, and in five you had Lex Luthor again. So, or Superman Returns. So it's good feeling. I think that also it's good to see that from what I've seen in the minute 33 trailer, which by the way is two trailers. One's voiceover by Russell Crowe, who plays Jor-El in the movie. One's voiceover by Kevin Costner, who plays Jonathan Kent, which I think that's a smart marketing idea. But it feels like you just said, it's a character developed movie. It's not a 10-minute, 15-minute rushed origin story that's bullshitted of like, you know, Russell Crowe throwing a baby into a rocket and it's gone. And you see a couple montages of him being raised by Kevin Costner. And then he goes into the big city and that's it. Like the other movies, which no offense to Christopher Reeve. You know, I love the first one. That's the first one ever. But, you know, like Joel Schumacher movies and before that, all these origin stories have always been rushed. And they don't give time to give you an understanding of these characters. And it's just... it's good to see that actually come out as like they're not focusing on the superhero. They're focusing on the person, the man that becomes the hero. So that's what I really like about it, because there's so much depth to Superman than just a big dude who has a lot of powers. You know, there's so much more to him than that. And I think that Snyder and the gang are going to do very well on this from what I've seen. Granted, it's way too early again. Let me say that again. But from what I've seen, I'm very happy. The trailer... gorgeous to me. Gorgeous.
I agree. The short and skinny of it is, and I think you would agree with this, it just gives us a lot of optimism that this thing might actually be in good hands for a change. And we might finally get that Superman film that character deserves.
Absolutely.
So, well, I'm sure we'll have a Superman-centric podcast at some point next year. My goal over the next... 6 months is to read a lot of Superman. That's a character I just haven't read all that much, to be honest, and go back and watch all the Superman animated series and get kind of up to date on that character so I understand a little bit more, even though your point is a good one, and I think it leads into the Batman topic, and we will get into the Dark Knight Rises, but I think that one of the things that Batman Begins does so well, and I rewatched it as I do every time Nolan puts out a film, I watch all his stuff, the week or so before, but in Batman Begins, for the entirety of that film, you are told the story of why this guy put on a bat costume and what drives him to continue doing it. It's not about the Tumblr or the gadgets or anything else. Those are just kind of bonuses on top of this intense character study of this tortured kid who grew up without parents. You see a short snippet of why that happened, which that kind of has to be done, the Joe Chill scene. But then after that, you see the evolution of Bruce Wayne's mind and why it all matters. And then when you see The Dark Knight, everything makes sense. This guy hates crime. He hates, you know, people that show no respect for individuals and freedom and all these other kinds of things. And just the whole idea behind it, the reason Batman Begins works is I think the way they want to do – if they do Man of Steel that way, and the trailer would indicate to me that they're going to, then we're all – and by all, I mean all of us listening to this and all of us who love superhero films and great motion pictures in general are going to be in for a real treat next summer. Because if they can handle the Superman origin and motivation to the same adept level – to the highest degree that Chris Nolan has done over the last 7 years, I will jump for joy when I walk out of that theater.
What's good about it is that it doesn't seem hokey. It doesn't, you know, right. It doesn't seem campy, because Superman's always been portrayed as campy since the he came out in 1939, but since the 60s cartoons and all those, and the 70s movies with Reeves and Super Friends and all those things, he's always come off campy. He's always come off as the over-eccentric Boy Scout, which I can see why people don't like, because, you know, not everyone in this world loves Goody Two-Shoes, which is why more people, I guess, past couple years have been on the Batman side, because he's dark, he's gritty, he's more modern, he's more believable, he's more adaptable to watch and kind of, you know, be on the same side with. But Superman, especially to those who haven't seen it, go watch Superman versus the Elite. That is by far to me the best animated movie or anything animated with Superman that shows what an incredible character he is and like what he stands for. That he never rests. He has his ideals, the way he was raised, and that he literally would die to defend not only his beliefs, but to defend those he cares about. And I'm hoping that's what comes across. But, you know, again, we will wait and see.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that Public Enemies is another good thing to read because you kind of see, you were talking about, well, Batman's more approachable because of his beliefs and because of this and because of that. That juxtaposes the two of them together and kind of explains why both those characters are inexorably linked to one another in terms of their motivations. It's only their tactics that are different. But in terms of like their overwhelming beliefs and what they're trying to accomplish, those two characters are quite similar.
Right, and a perfect example of that would be Superman, Batman, Public Enemies. Whether you read the book or whether you go buy the animated movie, that shows a perfect example of like, yeah, they're both flawed in different ways, but they come together in unison to get the job done. And then at the very end, which is really funny, I watched it recently the other day. It's not funny, but it's a good point. Because it's better in monologue when you read it, but they showed in the movie where basically when you think Batman goes to his death, Superman looks at Lex Luthor and he's like, "You just killed my best friend," and just goes apeshit on it. Just goes nuts thinking that he just lost Batman. Because, you know, he lost a friend, but at the same time, you lose like a piece of yourself when like someone close to you dies. And that's what I've always loved about the Batman movies. They reiterate it over and over in this movie, but not to death. Like, the thing I hate about the Green Lantern movie, Ryan Reynolds, was like they mocked fear in a way because they did it so bad. Like, "I'm afraid. I'm afraid." And then at the end, "I'm not afraid." And he recites the fucking "and brightest and darkest night," blah, blah, blah. And he wins. Simple as that. What's great about the Batman movies is like he always mentions that he's not a guy. He's not a guy in a suit. He's a symbol. And that's what he's always set out to be since the first movie.
Yep.
He's meant to be a symbol, a sign of hope that people don't have to live in fear, that people can take control of their destiny, people can fight back, that people can stand up for themselves and do the right thing. And again, that's we'll get into that, I'm sure, right now. But
absolutely. The symbolic nature, it's not like this guy just decides to put on a bat costume because he loves bats or hates bats or whatever like that. The other thing that you were talking about when you were talking about the fear is used by Nolan in the three films in different ways. That sometimes it's an advantage, and sometimes it's a disadvantage. It's kind of realistic. You can mold fear and use it to your advantage, but unlike the way the awful Green Lantern film depicted it, it is a multifaceted thing that can be utilized by everybody at different times. Clearly, the Joker used it. Clearly, Scarecrow in particular used it. And then when Batman began to utilize it, it helped him at times. And then at other times, he had to almost absorb the fear and be afraid in order to take the final steps that he needed to take at different times. It was just – it's the full depth that Nolan goes into, that Nolan and Goyer go into with these three stories that has made this – and this is going to sound like – utter puffery, but I was really thinking about it last night. There have been some, and we haven't done this podcast, but we have teased it before, and we will get to it probably soon. The Trilogies podcast, the multi-film series podcast. There have been some amazing trilogies of films, clearly beginning with Star Wars, and then you have Indiana Jones. We're not going to talk about that fourth film.
What?
Yeah, exactly. That Bourne trilogy, the Matrix trilogy, at least for me, a lot of people didn't like the other two films, but and you know, tons more. Lord of the Rings.
Gotta go back in time.
Exactly. Back to the Future. You know, everything. There've been a million of them, but to me, and you're coming at somebody who believes that The Dark Knight was the best film that was ever made, and that Batman Begins was in the top five. I think that this signifies. And it's too early to say that this is how the population will feel as a whole because there's not enough history behind it. But in 20, 25 years, as the kids are starting to grow up that are 15 right now that are watching The Dark Knight or 20 who are watching The Dark Knight Rises and Batman Begins, I think that this trilogy is the best that's ever been done in film because there is not a weak point to be found anywhere. And I know that's hard for you because Star Wars means so much to you, and it means a lot to me too, but I can't come near a comparison there. But for me, this is the best trilogy of films that's ever been released.
I like that point. as big of a Star Wars fan I am, I will jump on the bandwagon of what we just said, and I would say this. I would enjoy watching Nolan's movies a little bit more than I would the Star Wars movies. But I say this, that Star Wars is a bigger deal in franchise because how it's changed everything in pop culture and everything in movies in the past four decades. Because I think you and me have had this argument before, where basically the thing with Batman is like they had something to go on. They had a format from Bob Kane, and they had something from DC, and they had inspiration already. You had a character, you just basically were able to tell your own story inside of it in a modern way. Whereas Star Wars was just basically a whole fucking just idea coming from George Lucas when he was brilliant at the time. And it was a fresh take, nothing before seen in theaters, nothing before seen anywhere else. And it was just a original concept that just flourished to basically its own animal that it is still alive today. I mean, even before the new set of movies came out in 1999 and so on, like, that franchise was still booming. You still had, like, tons of stuff, spin-offs, TV shows, games, movies, and all stuff. You kind of already had that with Batman in general as a logo and as a property. But as far as the Nolan property of Batman, I mean, Star Wars is still bigger because it came from nothing to me. And I think
I agree with you on that. I 100% agree with that point, and that was – when I was trying to make the determination last night about how it would be perceived down the road, Star Wars is so important because it didn't draw on anything. It may have drawn on amalgamations of maybe a little bit of Star Trek here, a little bit of something else George Lucas remembered from his childhood here, or whatever else. But in general, that Star Wars concept first showed up on screen and then everything materialized from the movie, whereas Nolan had the advantage of 60 years worth of comics, 60s television show, at least to some extent, a bunch of movies before, a few of which at the time were deemed good, and he was able to just kind of take that and mold it into his own story. So in effect, he adapted Batman, whereas Star Wars was an original concept that just shocked the world when it showed up on screen and people fell in love with these characters that they didn't even know. So, yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I don't think that it's a slap to Star Wars for my opinion to be that these three films are it for me. Certainly I'm biased in favor of Batman first and Nolan as well. Even if he hadn't made these films, he would still be my favorite director right now. But I also think that for this to come in second place to a lot of people, and of course this doesn't want to disrespect Lord of the Rings and all these things either. I just think that for me, there's no Ewoks in the Batman trilogy. There's no little things that you look to. The one thing that you and I agreed with that we didn't love about the second film at all, the one little thing was that we wish Nolan hadn't killed off Harvey Dent. And what to me was so refreshing about The Dark Knight Rises is it explained why they killed off Harvey Dent. Because it led to so much of the way that the story materialized in the final chapter that I look back on it now and say, look, in Nolan's universe, people do die, but they do it in different ways. And it's not every single villain that you show up against dies. The Joker didn't die. We just didn't see him in this film, clearly, because they didn't want to try and dredge that up, and it was unnecessary. But Nolan's telling his own story, and even though we think that, you know, Harvey Dent could have been a part of this movie, Harvey Dent was a part of this movie. The whole Dent act and putting people in jail for this kind of reason and being the symbol in front of the people while the Batman ran and everything else in the background, it just now makes a whole lot more sense why they did decide to kill him off, because it drove so much of the motivations for all the characters in the final Dark Knight story.
To piggyback off that, basically, Dent was just basically a martyr.
Right.
He was basically a reason why, you know, an excuse really, because they made the Harvey Dent law and all that stuff in the day, was it 7-8 years past, and things changed around in Gotham. The thing to go on the Heath Ledger thing with Joker, I think the way media works and the way society works is like, if people, and I remember there were rumors for a long time that like Nolan's like, well, we have footage of Ledger we didn't use, we may use it, we may not. I think the brilliant thing that he did was there's no mention of Joker, because I think the slight name of the Joker would have just overshadow the entire presence of Bane and what they were doing in the movie. I think any kind of notion would have just killed, like, the momentum of the way that movie was paced to me.
Couldn't agree more with that, and I'm glad you mentioned it because I wanted to get to it. My God, did I love Tom Hardy and that Bane character in this movie. I know it's kind of hard to hear. Even in IMAX, it's hard to hear every word that's being said, and I can't wait to watch this on Blu-ray with subtitles so I get every word. I love the way the voice sounded coming through that mask and the way that a lot of those lines were delivered. But just in terms of that character and the way it emerged and the way they told the story and the execution of it and every bit of it, I could not have been more pleased with Bane in The Dark Knight Rises.
From the very beginning, it definitely has just – from the moment his voice comes out of the mask, you kind of get excited. And what's crazy was they did the same thing with him they did with the Joker.
Yep.
You know he's there in the beginning, but you don't see him obviously initially. You just kind of have that sense and that presence.
They show him twice with the hood on, whereas in The Dark Knight you get – the Joker's back turned with the duffel bag with the mask hanging off of it before they go into the bank.
Oh, I killed the bus driver.
Yeah, exactly. So,
poor bus driver.
But you even had the unmasking moment. Instead of saying, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stranger, you have him, who is that? Who are you? And he takes off the mask and there's Bane right there staring at the guy. And then, what is your plan or whatever? And he breaks out with the whole, to crash this plane with no survivors, and then everything just kind of goes from there. It's like there's a definite, you know, you're watching Nolan, but man,
he's so cocky and he's so just arrogant. It's so good.
Yeah, it is.
Because the guy was like, well, you meant to get captured? Yes.
Of course. I'll tell you, man, that plane scene was just amazing. Mm-hmm. Everything, just watching Bane kind of float and hold on to the seats, and just how, like, seamlessly they had the scene with the IV, where it goes into the guy's arm and everything just kind of flows.
Right.
And then when he holds on to Dr. Pavel and the plane drops underneath him, you just the way that's shot, you're just like, my God, this guy is so good.
Dropped, I thought for a second, I was like, are they going to do like a Wile E. Coyote thing and see like a little dust poof? Like, pff, but no, they didn't. Yeah. They cut away. But so fucking just, I would say 90% dead on Bane character because.
Oh, yeah.
How smart he was,
yeah.
How much stronger he was, how long it took him to develop every single plan that came into the play in this whole thing, from kidnapping the doctor to stealing the reactor to hunting down Batman, setting up the trap for Batman to fucking blowing up the stadium to isolate Gotham, which made me think it was like a throwback to like Arkham City in a way, because like, oh, he just barricaded the whole city. And then basically just breaking him, literally. And they did do the scene. There was no indication at all before the movie came out that scene was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And to do so, just the way they executed it was just my jaw dropped. I was like, oh!
There were a couple of – it's interesting. When I recorded Beyond the Box Score at WKCT – on Wednesday, we were talking just a little bit about the film. He's like, so Bane's just kind of a meathead, right? He's just kind of a steakhead. That's everything I've ever seen about him. And I said, no. And he goes, well, you know the character better than me. Tell me. I said, he's one of the most brilliant people that's ever existed in the superhero universe. He's one of the only people to ever outsmart Batman. And
not outsmart him, but outmatch him.
Yeah, everything. Pretty much in every way. And you could tell from the airplane scene, at the very beginning of this film, that Nolan knew who Bane was, and he had a defined vision for what he was going to make Bane into. And I don't know about you, there were several, I mean, there were just tons of good scenes that we'll get to, but the obvious, the first confrontation when they're fighting and you hear Bane talking to him, and you hear just kind of Bane's thought processes and what's going through his mind while he's saying these different things, and obviously when he picks him up and says, is it going to be your spirit? Or your body, and breaks him across his knee and everything else. It's like, God, he nailed Bane so well in every aspect that it's like you can't go back and try to compare between the Joker and Bane. You can just say that those two villains in particular amazing.
Here's a similar story to your co-host on your other show. Had a girl come to the bank the other day, and just this, she just one, I'll say this because I don't really care. She was a troll looking.
Okay.
Little three times her probably body weight that she's supposed to be. Comes in like, oh my god, I can't believe that they made this movie with Bane, but they didn't do it with Poison Ivy. Like, that's messed up. I came out of my office on a conference call, and I was like, whoa, first off, that movie was terrible. Second off, you don't know anything about Batman if that's what you're basing this whole thing on,
right.
On why you're upset about this movie. Third, get out.
Fourth, no, seriously, get out.
I was so offended, and it's Joel Schumacher's fucking fault.
Yeah, it is.
Because you fucking rip apart this brilliant character who, in the comics, he was born in the prison. That part they got right, but he was born from a revolutionist, which yep. The country punished the revolutionist by throwing his only child into this prison, which he was raised, and he escaped as an adult. He literally learned to fight in this cage, in this fucking prison his entire life, and read every book that he could, and basically he dominated the prison. He eventually ran the prison from himself, and basically when he escaped, heard all these stories and legends from the prisoners about Batman and thought that it was his destiny to fight and destroy Batman because of the symbol that Batman stood for. He was like, because he was haunted by dreams of bats in his as a child. So he thought, oh, this is my calling. This is my reckoning. This is the guy I will destroy and utterly just make my fucking imprint on.
Right.
So that part was very similar of why he chose Batman and to raise hell. And it just sickens me that, yeah, back Batman and Robin, that was done. It was just Poison Ivy's fucking monkey.
Yeah, I mean, there was that. Even the animated series, you go back and Bane was treated really well, but people just didn't see it.
Because you only get 30 minutes. You get exactly. 32 minutes.
You get 19, actually. Almost all those episodes weren't even 20 minutes long at the time because Fox had so much going in terms of ad revenue that they weren't all that long. So you still don't get that much, but a lot of people have never seen that. And a lot of people, the only thing they know about Bane is the neon serum. And how brilliant is it that no one doesn't even use the serum?
Yeah, they don't even use Venom, which to me, I was a little hesitant. I was like, why would he not do that? Because that is part of Bane. But again, it's just the same thing we talked about with Batman Begins. We talked about the same thing with Joker. We talked about the same thing with the Man of Steel trailer. What he did was he focused not on this drug addicting, you know, Bane, which in the comics, Bane has to have Venom pumped through his veins every 12 hours, or otherwise right. He will debilitate because he was chosen for this experiment when he was younger, when he was in prison, because they basically thought, oh, God, this guy is going to fucking ruin us all. We should kill him because this Venom serum has killed everyone else. Let's fucking give it to him. Backfires, and he becomes this fucking brute monster strength. But again, he has pumped into his veins every 12 hours of what he fucking breaks down. That being said, as you can tell, no one, no notion of that because he doesn't want to focus on that. He's focusing on just the psychology of Bane.
Yeah, they just go. He just tells the story of basically Bane getting the shit beat out of him trying to save Talia, and
which great spin, by the way. I didn't fucking see that coming. I sort of did, but then they did so many flashbacks and so many like scenes where he's like, he's Bane, he's Ra's al Ghul's son, and even he was like, I am the League of Shadows.
Yeah, what was weird to me is, when I heard that, I had already talked to Jeremy before we had walked in because he was asking more about Ra's, and I was like, well, you know, Ra's is such an important character, and so is his daughter. She and Batman have had relationships on and off, and she's played both sides of the fence at different times and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, I wonder if Talia would ever show up because I had heard Liam was going to be a part of this film and all this kind of stuff. But what's interesting is when you see it, you think it's Bane, and then when you see the kid, it looks like Marion Cotillard in the face in terms of the eye spacing, but you don't really pick up on it because you're listening to what Batman's saying while he's believing in this story that's being told to him.
Because
Bruce Wayne is.
It's so deceiving in a good way. You're kind of lit off that trail because of everything else going on in the movie. Plus, again, he's for sure like, this is Ra's son.
Right.
Like, you're so sure with him. You're like, okay, he knows what he's doing.
I felt like Cotillard was going to turn out to be a villain. I just didn't – like, when it was Talia, it was kind of in the back of my head, but I didn't feel like it was necessarily going to go that route. But when it happened, I was just like, yes, yes, yes.
I applauded, too.
The only the other big twist, and again, this is a spoiler. I know I said in the preview that it wasn't going to be a spoiler, but you will know by this point there is one. But as soon as I saw Joseph Gordon-Levitt on screen the third time, I knew where they were going. I just didn't know which one it was going to be. And when I heard Blake was the name, what ran through my head was, well, this is Tim Drake. That's what this feels like to me.
It was kind of a mix.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, his name is John Blake, which sort of was similar to Drake in different ways. I thought, potentially, when Batman told him you need to put on a mask to protect those around you and those you care about, that he was potentially going to go right to Nightwing, and they weren't even going to do Robin.
Right, because the rumor was for a long time that the symbols that he kept drawing with the chalk was the Nightwing symbol. It wasn't a Batman symbol. It looked very similar. But, I mean, you and me had a discussion back in the past, like, Tim Drake's Robin, the third Robin in the whole, like, mythology, is my favorite Robin.
Yeah.
Because it's similar to Wayne's story. He knows, as a kid, he finds out that Bruce Wayne is Batman just through his own detective knowledge and doing research, newspapers, articles, and just doing all this thing himself as a kid, which is pretty much Batman, because Batman is the world's greatest detective. And it's a good throwback. And at the same time, I wasn't at all offended whatsoever with the screen time that he got and his character at all. I applauded it.
It was great.
Very well done. And it was good to see him confront Bruce. He's like, you know, we need you.
Yeah, it was the whole thing, like, when it happened, the whole theater erupted in applause when he said, why don't you use my full name? And she said, I like that name, Robin, and everybody just started applauding or whatever. It was so well executed again. And then when all of it was going down, you just knew Levitt was going to turn out to be important, and you kind of figured it out, because if you've read the comics and you and I really love Tim Drake, Drake was more of a detective. And when Gordon said, you're a detective now, you can't believe in coincidences. I was just like, okay. And it was just a matter of, well, are they actually going to fully let him reveal himself to turn into this character or not? And obviously when he said put on a mask, you could see it coming. But when he threw the badge into the water at the very right towards the end, you knew exactly what was coming. And it was still just as satisfying when it happened.
Right.
They did. Another thing is, Robin's obviously sometimes portrayed as campy as hell. We were talking about Superman being campy. Robin is campy.
Yeah, the media always brags on him, like, right. He's so colorful, he's gay, whatever.
This tells the gritty origin story of Robin.
But he's
coming it up.
But he's the balance of Batman, right. Is what's always so good about Robin. Robin kind of keeps fucking Batman's psyche in check to, like, not go over the edge, to not push those limits that, you know, he did this for a reason. And basically, he always, in a sense, will always kind of look at Robin in some fashion or form, whether it be Drake, whether it be Jason Todd, whether it be, you know, Grayson. He looks at him like, this is where I came from, you know. And stories with Batman, he's already, in so many ways, with, like, the Venom storyline, Long Halloween, the Killing Joke. I can't remember exactly. The one where basically, there's a story, I can't remember, you tell me what it is if you can remember, where basically Batman puts himself purposely to go crazy, puts himself in a submerged tank to just shut himself off from the world because he wants to understand the mind of the Joker. So he literally makes himself insane purposely so he can kind of understand his own opponent. So in the comics, Batman's put himself into edges and not, and even it has what the hamburger with Batman of Azrael,
whatever it is.
It has this like mental block in his head, so in case his mind were ever to get taken over, he can come back and figure things out. But Robin's, again, Batman's a symbol of hope. Robin's more of the symbol of innocence, that you can do the right thing, but at the same time keep face, like be a vigilante, but in a good way, where like people are more accepting. He's not feared like Batman.
No, it's just you look back on it now, today, after you saw it last night, obviously, and I saw it twice the night before. It's such a just mastery, just such a beautiful thing to witness the fact that you're watching the end of The Dark Knight with the whole The Dark Knight Ends and all the stuff leading up to this thing. And in the process of paying attention to Batman's ending, to the finale and how he's trying to save the world and come back from what had happened at the end of The Dark Knight and everything that's going on in Gotham. You're also watching the origin story of Robin, and you don't even really pick up on it until you walk out of the theater and realize just how much screen time Joseph Gordon-Levitt got. And you're just like, damn, that was good. Like, it's just amazing. And, of course, obviously they picked the right guy for it because JGL is just incredible. But, my God, it's like Robin has never been put in a more positive light ever and never will be than what took place in that 2 hours and 45 minutes.
Chris O'Donnell can go suck on it. I will say this also. In today's day and age with Facebook, Twitter, media, TMZ, and all these sites, superhero hype, that get like the lowdown on movies on the minute while they're filming, it's still amazing to me that Nolan was able to disguise Liam Neeson in the movie as well as he did, and that, you know, the denial of Robin. Since Dark Knight came out back 4 years ago, people were like, oh, is the next one going to have Robin? He was like, hell no.
And when you add, and when if
Christian
you look
Bale
at,
even came on interviews after Dark Knight came out. Right. Well, even in, but even when Christian Bale was asked, are you going to have a Batman with Robin? He's like, no. Christian Bale, in interviews, you can go look for these. He's like, I will not do a Batman with Robin. Refuse to.
Yeah. And there was and there was JGL, and they would continually, people would ask who he was. He's just like, I'm just a police officer. I'm just this guy named John who's a police officer in Gotham.
I totally believed it.
Yeah, I did too. I mean, he thought he was just going to be the police officer that had lines, that was just kind of on the front lines with Gordon. You never for a second really saw what was happening, even though I figured it out about 20 minutes into the movie where they might go. I even looked at Jeremy and I was like, hey, Jeremy, man, I think I know what they're going to do here. And didn't say what it was. I was like, I think I just figured out who he is. But my goodness, yeah, in 2012, for that not to have leaked and everybody to have known it is a feat of mastery. Unbelievable. It's absolutely unbelievable. And my
I don't know if that's some kind of clause with the studio or whether Nolan has it in with these actors and crew enough to be like, look, no one say shit.
And what a,
I will stab you.
What a reveal. And we're not going to end this discussion here, but just that last moment when the platform's starting to rise, and that's when you know the film's ending because you hear the crescendo.
Let's save the last piece. Let's go. Because we talked about Tom Hardy as Bane, which, again, fucking just brilliant beyond belief. Like, I will say this. As much as I love the Joker, Bane was by far better as a villain, as a character to me than Joker. Because you still don't get everything in Joker, which is fine. And you never will, obviously, and sad enough. We'll get the character depth of Joker. You get what you get on screen, which is phenomenal, which is a, you know, psychopath that's smarter than he appears to be and leads off to. And he's organized, and he knows what he's doing. But Bane, from just the minis on screen to his origin to the end, everything, to when he's blown away by Catwoman, which is funny to me, it is just a good all-around villain. And I can't remember the last time I saw someone on screen be that formidable to their counterpart.
There were no moments that I can look to when Tom Hardy wasn't on the screen that he didn't own it, that character wasn't the focus of your eyes. Just something about it, just everything about it. And like you and I, you in particular, I think had – we didn't love the mask when we saw pictures of it and everything else. I love it now. I love just everything about how it looked in the end and everything else, but I can't pick between the two of them. Heath Ledger's performance, I think, is the best thing I'd ever seen. And before that, it was Anthony Hopkins in The Silence of the Lambs with the Hannibal Lecter villain character. But Bane is not going to be outdone. Bane is on the short list of no matter what. I don't want to pick between the two of them, so I'll just call it a dead tie. But Bane was more fully fleshed out. And it was interesting. And it certainly wasn't trying to be hidden. I don't know what, if it was necessarily intentionally done this way, but this film was a direct mirror and a commentary on the state of society in regard to what took place with the Occupy movement, even to the point where Gordon called it an occupation when he was trying to get the the other high, or whoever's, what was his name? What was the name of the character Matthew Modine played?
Asshole?
Yeah, pretty much. But basically, it was a condemnation, at least to me, it was a clear condemnation of Occupy and big government, because it was more of a response to it's individuals who have hope and families and people like a Batman, it was a symbol of hope and symbol of good, and people like Jim Gordon who aren't dealing with corruption in terms of the process and all this that are actually making things happen. That there's corruption all over the place, that everybody's bought off, that Bane shows up and says, take your city back, but in effect he's controlling every single person. He's trying to create anarchy and destroy all these people. And through this like demonstration of what happens when it gets out of control and when mob rule takes over, they even show the executives or whoever being hanged and hung out where people can see them, which is a throwback to the French Revolution of 1789 when they did the exact same thing to try and show the difference. They were pulling the rich out of their homes into the streets and beating them to death. They were sentencing people to death without trial, without fair trial, death or exile, that whole situation. All of it was like this direct sense back to what's happened in politics over the last two or three years. I certainly don't think that Chris Nolan's a conservative. I'd love to find out he was, but this was an incredible conservative message that was illustrated through the way that this story was told, and it just added another layer to what they were already doing. I just thought it was brilliant.
Matthew Modine played Foley, which I don't really remember too much of him from the comics, if he's even in the comics. I was really, again, another attempt at this movie that they put so many characters into a movie that didn't overwhelm and overshadow one another. Kind of like, let's go back on Spider-Man 3, where you have too many main villains, but neither one of them are brought to screen to light enough in their own justice. Roland Daggett, let me give you an example. Really good that he was in the movie, because Daggett in the Batman series, basically, for those who've seen Iron Man 2 and have even maybe read, he's basically the Justin Hammer of the Batman mythology.
Right.
He's the rival of Wayne Enterprises. He's the guy that wants to take over. He's the guy that wants to infiltrate.
It's kind of Obadiah Stane, too.
Exactly. He's the guy that wants to be the head honcho. Man, can I say this? Anything Brett Cullen's in, just a scumbag.
Yeah, no kidding.
His congressman? Like, seriously?
I love that guy, though, man.
That's all I want to say. I was like, damn it.
He's not going to be a good character.
Nope, not at all. I was like, I just do not have a good feeling about this. And then my man Thomas Lennon.
Yeah. When Dangle popped on the screen, I laughed.
This is me clapping for Thomas Lennon in that movie. Woo!
I was just, man.
Lieutenant Dangle.
He was in it for 30 seconds, and it was just awesome. And here's the thing. We haven't even talked about Anne Hathaway.
No, let's do that next. We had to get Bane out of the way, so let's go to that. Again, brilliant, I would say.
It was awesome, and she wasn't overused, and she wasn't over-focused.
Fucking chemistry.
And my God, is she beautiful.
My God, was she hot in that maid's outfit. But anyway.
I liked her in the second dress, the dress when she went into the bar.
Yeah, oh yeah, good God, yeah.
Man.
But same thing, she when she first shows on the screen, you obviously know going into the movie she's Catwoman, so you know this little May thing she's just playing with, but she does it well to the point where, like, oh my gosh, she can do like that flip on a switch.
When she said, after... Oops.
Right.
Yeah, that's when it turned and you're like, oh, okay, brilliant, way to go.
Her falling out the window the way she did was really cool, because I was like, oh, that's totally Catwoman-ish there. And just, they did enough for her, I think. They didn't really go too far into her story, except for like little mentions where Wayne is reading her like record file as Batman or Wayne, whatever, and he's like, I know you're doing Kyle, this and that, blah, blah, blah. But I think her motivations were always just plain and simple. What she wanted was basically get out, clear her name, or like Black Widow says in Avengers, clear the blood off her sheet, whatever. Start over fresh. But you know that there's more to her than just being a selfish thief.
And you get that reveal in the final stanza. We'll get to that here in just a bit. But just her performance and the way that Catwoman's a very important part of the Batman universe, always has been. But this film was not about the Catwoman. This film was Catwoman being a part of what's going on around it on both sides. And I thought that Anne Hathaway did the best thing that she did in the entire film, to me, was when she closed the gate and left Batman to Bane and said, I had to clear my name. And you see right. Batman getting beaten within an inch of his life, and it keeps going back to her face a couple of times, and you can see her move from being this thief that only cares about herself to somebody who's starting to believe she might have done the wrong thing. And you can see it in her eyes, and you can see it in the way her mouth opens towards the end of the fight, and she's like, my God, he's going to kill him. What was I doing? Why did I do this? It's just like this subtle reminder that the true Catwoman always played both sides of the fence. Mm-hmm. And at times had crises of consciousness, and at times was just a thief who cared about nobody but herself. And it was just, it was just another piece of this. Catwoman was basically the scarecrow of this film, except that she played both sides of it. But in terms of screen time, she was about as important to what was going on as what Cillian Murphy was to Batman Begins, which is to say incredibly important, but it didn't take 45 minutes of her being on screen to make it happen.
Which, speaking of Cillian Murphy, his performance in the movie, it's just funny.
It was.
I couldn't tell whether he was psychotic, though. I was like, he looks crazy.
Did you see his jacket?
Yeah.
Like, you could kind of make the scarecrow out of the jacket?
Pretty much, because it was, like, picked off at, like, the corners of his, like shoulders and stuff.
Feathers were coming off. Yeah.
Death well, I couldn't tell whether exile. He was just psychotic, because, like, the way he was, pretty much, oh, you know what? Exile by death, or whatever. Yeah. Death by exile.
Death. Yeah. Seems like it. Okay, then. Death it is. By exile.
What I thought was really funny, and I'm waiting for Robot Chicken to do this, was you remember in Daredevil with Ben Affleck where the cop lights the little match on fire and there's the double D's right there in the floor?
Yeah.
And it lights up. And then when in the movie with Batman when he's like, light it up.
Yeah,
the whole thing. Flare goes off.
Yeah.
I was like, I want to see that scene that's cut off in the movie where he made that. Show me that awkward, like, 2-3 hour scene where Batman's got to drug out some fucking gasoline on that bridge, and then he's got to just slinging around and paint it. He's hanging by some wires. Get this fucking bat symbol on there. The fucking news coppers going around like, there's a man on the bridge.
How did nobody see him?
No shit. How much gas did that fucking take to fucking sling that shit? Just tell me that. That was good to see that finally because you see it in the poster for The Dark Knight, and you never see that in the movie The Dark Knight.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. I've got that framed IMAX poster from The Dark Knight right behind me, behind my recliner, and I'm looking at the bat symbol on the building, which actually could never happen because there's glass in the building.
But I can see my chicken doing that because they did it with Daredevil where he like was like 40 minutes before. He's like just trying to spell out this name, but I could see that, or like Family Guy was making fun of that, like, you know, like a cutback, and it's just so awkward. Like, just show me that. Like, how long did that fucking take?
Think about how close that actually was to where the trials were being held and where all the bad folks were. My man's just doing it under the cover of night. Nobody sees any of this. Like, who's that black guy? Who's that dude in black on the ice that's, like, carving something into this wall up in a straight line?
Damn.
Yeah, I look back on it, and I know that the one reviewer, and again, I've read nothing, basically, but that one reviewer was getting death threats. And I watched, like, on a news special, they were talking about he was getting death threats because he didn't like the film, because he called it tedious, and that so much of it was unnecessary. I just like to sit down with him as a big-time Batman guy, and I'd love to do it with you, and just ask him what exactly was unnecessary. Mm-hmm. About that. And, you know, obviously most of the action takes place in the second half of the film. I have a real affinity for the first half of the film because of the dialogue setting up so much of the exposition in the story. And again, getting to the motivations of all these characters and giving you a window into what's going on. And another just masterful, and I've used that word 3 times now, performance by Michael Caine. Because I loved Alfred in this film.
I do too, and for the short screen time that he actually was on was really well done, and it showed the more in-depth relationship for him and Bruce than all of the previous 4 films of 4 Nolans combined. Because it shows how much he cares about him, how much he, you know, is always been there for him no matter what decision he has in life. And how hard it was for him to be like, either you stop this shit, or I walk away.
Yeah.
And it he already knew that he was going to walk away, and he built that moment like, this hurts me more than you. It was kind of, you know, kind of bromance-ish, but
yeah,
get the point.
The whole I've cared about you since you were a boy and all that kind of stuff is like, yeah, these, you know, they're close, but he's basically his father.
Yeah.
Albert's basically his father, or his grandfather. He's his Obi-Wan, I guess you could say.
I've seen some reviews where they've either said this movie was clunky and ill-paced, or I actually read one that was on Rotten Tomatoes where they said that this was Nolan's worst film to date.
Look, I watched every single one of them this week. Like I said, I do that every time Nolan puts out a film. I watched everything he's ever done. They're all brilliant. Insomnia is still the worst. It's good. It's real good, but it's the worst. It's not close. But this, I can't rank these films. I just can't do it yet. I'm not far enough away from The Dark Knight Rises to do it and make any sense of it. That's why when I wrote my long-ass winded review last night, I said it may have done the unthinkable, but I don't know. But from being, I'll tell you this, and I think I want your opinion on it. From an emotional investment standpoint, this one dominated the other two.
Oh, yeah.
100%. In terms of how much you were into the characters and you felt the, how bleak was this movie in terms of like hopeless at times and just like, just how bad you felt at times. Like when,
no, I really thought he was, I thought he was going to die. I really thought that Nolan
was going to, I started
to
believe they were going to kill him off.
I thought it was gonna, he was going to die and Gordon Levitt was going to somewhat break into the Batcave and take it from there and be like, you know, in honor of him kind of thing. But I was like, when they showed the scene with Morgan Freeman, again, we were rushing to the end so fast. But yeah, no, but
well, we can't talk about every word of it. I mean, I'm trying to think. We can go back again. We haven't even talked about the wonderful stock market scene and the first appearance of Batman coming across in the Bat Cycle and grabbing that guy from the side. And that's when that iconic Hans Zimmer pulse pounding spot hits. And it's just like, my man, they've just knocked this thing completely out of the park.
Speaking of reviewers, I will say that I just remember the name a little bit ago. Stephanie Zacharek from MovieLine.com. There was a 2 or 3 month sprint where she gave every single movie review. I mean, everything you think of from March up until like last month in June, everything a C. Even the Avengers gave it a C. Like, she hated everything that just came, or like just didn't care, or like just, I just don't understand that. To me, I don't know. Have some. Everyone's entitled to their opinion, but I just don't understand stuff like that where it's like, eh, everything's mediocre.
Right.
I'm more on the love it or don't. If you don't, fool, that's your opinion. I'm not going to knock into it unless you tell me that you don't like this movie because there's no poison ivy. anyway, just kind of throwing that since you were talking about a reviewer note. Anyway, Gary Oldman.
My
tough, gritty. I love the fact they kept using the term war hero.
Yeah.
And basically, I like that scene, too, where Bane somehow or another steals that letter off of him and reads it to the crowd, which is a brilliant scene because it just basically is like, oh, well, now I reveal the honest truth to crush everyone's spirit and hopes.
That's an Occupy move. Again, that like him standing up. And one of the best lines in the whole film is when Tom Hardy looks up after that and he goes, do you accept this man's resignation? And he said, do you accept all of their resignations? And that's when he blows open the prison and everything really hits. But it's just like, again, Bane was so calculated in every move that he made in the film, and clearly the way that he was being portrayed was somebody who had his shit in gear, knew what he was doing, knew what he wanted to accomplish, and knew what was going to happen as a result of it. Like, he had it all mapped out. It was just like, again, when he did that, you said crush the spirit. That's exactly right. It's like, you can't rely on your God. You can't rely on these martyrs that you've put up as being your heroes. You can't rely on anybody. It's all lies. So just run this shit the way you want to. Just go ape crap and take people out, kill them, whatever you want to do, because it was just basically preaching anarchy in a similar fashion to the Joker, except the Joker was just doing it because he's a nut job.
Right.
The whole some people just want to watch the world burn situation from the second one. Bane knew what he was doing. They had a clear idea of what he was doing.
What I liked was the fact that he lied to the people, and he's like, any of you can set it off the detonation.
Right.
But then they were like, no, that shit's going off no matter what, man.
It was funny that Bruce, he would never, it's like, he would never give it to an ordinary citizen. And everybody that was smart in the film realized that, somebody was going to have it that was important.
Because it was his arrogance again. It's kind of right. Like Loki from the Avengers. When Iron Man has a realization, he's like, you know, he wants to hit us like this. He wants to hit us and show the world, dear God. And he realizes that he's on his own tower. It's kind of like when Batman realizes how arrogant Bane is. He's like, he would never let someone just randomly choose the fate of his whole operations. It would backfire in his face. But Gary Oldman, just brilliant again. And I love the scene where he's getting out of the bed trying to, because he knows someone's going to come after him. And you don't see it, but you hear the gunshots and he's standing there putting the gun to the gore in the vet's head.
Watch
like,
the corner, rookie.
Yeah, like training him, like, hey, you should know better kind of thing. But I loved everything that he did in the movie. Everything the war hero symbol, continuing the fight. And the truck scene when he's trying to get to the detonator shows how tough he can be, even in his state. So
the one thing that I didn't know we were going to see or didn't anticipate was the whole idea, the Dark Knight Rises of the name being literal in terms of Bruce having to crawl out of that, you know, affectation pit and make that jump and actually having to rise up and failing two or three times. That whole sequence of him failing and him getting the knowledge of what fear should mean and not using the harness and all that stuff with those other just minor characters that popped in, that was something I didn't anticipate.
I actually did. Because I knew, like, every time they showed the camera angle from the bottom of the little pit, I was like, this reminds me exactly of, like, his dad coming to rescue him in the first movie.
Yeah.
Which I'm like, they're gonna show that. There's going to be some kind of inspiration or dream to haunt him. And two, I don't know, any kind of action movie always has that little moment where the hero takes off the restraints or goes nuts. Like, to me, I knew he was going to take off the harness because in my head, this is just fucked up. I thought of Van Damme from Kickboxer. When basically in the final scene of Kickboxer, when he's fighting in the last round, instead of using the gloves with the glass on it, he has the chick take it off. And he's like, cut me loose. And he just goes barehanded, beating the shit out of Tong Po. And in my head, I was like, okay, so he's not going to use the rope in the last part because he's basically, it's all or nothing for him. He's so broken that it's basically he has nothing to lose.
If I don't make this, I die, and we move on.
It's this, but it's like if I can't make this, then I can't save the world anyway. So this has to count for something. So I thought that was obviously it was. You could see it from a mile coming away, but I still want to see it, and it was still well done. Especially when everyone was cheering for him, I was like, I thought these guys were going to like murder him if he came back down. But they're like, no, you get the fuck out of here. And the doctor was sitting there smiling, the blind guy. So, fucking Quinn in the movie. God, why would they put that dude in the movie?
Shoot at his feet.
What was his name? What's his name in real life? You know it.
I can't remember his name.
All right. Well, you speak about. Let's see. We got Anne Hathaway. Morgan Freeman. Start with Morgan Freeman. I'll look up his name.
It's interesting that Fox was shown early on as a president who's like, no, you lost all your money, Mr. Wayne. Like, that he's responsible for a lot of his own failures and just kind of walking away and turning into Howard Hughes. They even allude to the whole he's got 8-inch fingernails and he's peeing in mason jars early on because he just kind of disappears. Another thing surprised me is I didn't realize that The Dark Knight Rises was going to take place 8 years after Harvey Dent. Like 8 years after the end of The Dark Knight is when the third film begins. That I did not expect.
That's what's brilliant.
When it started out, when it looked like it was starting out, or at least after the airplane scene, you see the whole vigil scene at the end, and you're just like, whoa, wait, so almost no time has passed. Well, no, 8 years have passed, and Batman just disappeared. The only thing I was wondering is, like, how can nobody in Gotham realize that the last time anybody saw Batman was also the last time Bruce Wayne appeared in public?
Right.
It's like you probably start to pick up on the fact that two people we haven't seen in 8 years, and one of them, when he wears his mask, his mouth looks a lot like Bruce Wayne's.
Or the first time is like, Bruce Wayne comes back from the dead out of nowhere. All of a sudden, this mass vigilante shows up. Let me get this straight. Jonathan Blake got it right. Okay, so he was the one person that figured all this out.
And Bane.
Right. But just like Bane, though, Bane already probably figured it out years ago.
Yeah.
Before he had to go disappear and all that shit. In the comics, Bane hunts Batman for over, like, I think 2 years. And his plan takes around 3 to 4 months because he doesn't just go like a normal villain and just go say, I'm going to fight Batman or rob a bank to get his attention. He'll come out and I'll try to beat his ass. No. He manipulates and he contemplates and he plays a chess game by breaking out every single supervillain out of Arkham Asylum, busting a hole open so they can escape, which is a scene obviously in the movie where he busts out of prison, but that's a whole other thing. But he basically leaves it to Batman to go hunt these motherfuckers down individually, and after 3 or 4 months, Batman is literally so tired. There's a scene where basically Batman has almost a beard because he's so just drawn out and tired of hunting these assholes down, that Bane is just already beating up Alfred. He's just in the he's in the Wayne Manor, just staring at him like, all right, now it's my turn. Like, just, and goes at him at his weakest point. It's kind of like Money in the Bank for WWE. You attack the champion at his weakest point. So he gets him, and basically, literally, as you spoke before, breaks the bat. He's the only man to this day in 20-something years to break the bat, break his body and mind and everything like that. So to me, that's what's brilliant about this. Is like same thing. You're led to one thing, believe, and he purposely leads him to him just for a one-on-one fight, and.
Which is exactly what happens in the film. I mean, you realize that he's not just trying to take the stock market down to bankrupt everybody. No, he's trying to bankrupt Bruce Wayne to where Wayne has nothing left at all. Like, financially, emotionally, he's been destroyed. So when he goes after Bane that first time, and Bane looks at him and says, let's dispense with the pleasantries, Mr. Wayne, and that's when Hathaway realizes who he is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, no, Bane knew exactly what he was doing. He went – the whole stock exchange thing was to try and bankrupt Wayne Industries so that Talia could get control of it and so that he could lure Batman out.
Right.
And it was just so well constructed from a story perspective that there's just not a whole lot of plot holes in these films.
No, but
everything pretty much just fits exactly the way it should.
But in the motorcycle scene, even when Bane gets away, he knew how to get away because he knew Batman would keep chasing the other guy and let him be. Purposely. They even said it like, he just let him get away.
Yeah.
So, A to B, he had everything in the right mind, except until, you know, Catwoman shot him in the face with the bat cycle. Which.
So he died?
I would assume he died. He got blasted by a cannon.
That's what I thought. But I was like, you know, Bane's pretty strong. You never know.
He got blasted by a cannon. I'm pretty sure you died.
But again, in Nolan's universe, you know, the characters do die, and as we get to the final stanza of the film, the question that you're left with, and another just great piece of forethought in the way that the film orchestrated, was the speech early in the film where Alfred talks about going on vacation yearly and hoping to see Bruce happy, sitting across from him in the cafe just one time, and you see this daydream in Alfred's head. Mm-hmm. While he's telling the story, you're like, wow, that's nice. And then when they do it again at the end of the film and you know exactly what's about to happen, and then it actually does, it's just, you could not have asked. And just the way, the look on Bale's face, the like sly grin that he has on his face, and just the nod that he gives Alfred. And then you could see Anne Hathaway across the table from him as somebody else, because the other thing that before the real final confrontation happens, basically, Bruce tells Selina, look, you don't want to be a thief. You want to move on from this. That's why you want this clean slate. You really want to try and let your past behind you. When you see that spot at the end when they're together, what you start to think is, wait, there is no Catwoman anymore. There's no Batwoman. There's no Batman, and there's no Catwoman. Bruce and Selina have left together to move on in their lives. And it's just like, wow, Nolan just told his own story and ended another character but in a way that you never expected that Catwoman was going to end that film in that kind of way.
But he finds happiness finally, exactly. Which is great. And he finds peace, and I think for himself and for everyone, because as a fan, you're just like, cool, he ends up with the woman, he ends up alive, and he saves the day.
And he leaves the legacy.
He doesn't go out dead like a vigilante anymore.
He leaves a legacy.
He's not hunted.
And another thing Nolan does is, through the character of John Blake, you see Levitt's anger continue to rise. His rage continued to rise. I can't deal with injustice. Right. Like, even what he says to Gordon, I can't deal with this injustice from an organized perspective. I've got to do this on my own. And it's like, he is what Bruce was at the beginning when he first put on the bat costume, when he decided that he was going to go avenge stuff. The way they told Robin out is, by the time he gets into the Batcave at the end of the film, he is what Bruce was at the beginning. So everything comes full circle. Bruce has moved on in his life, and now his heir pretty much is just somebody that's going to follow forward with that legacy. It's Bruce can walk away knowing that somebody is still going to be there as a symbol to protect Gotham.
That's the thing. Same thing. Like we said, we talked about Robin earlier in the discussion, that basically every time Batman sees Robin, he sees himself.
Right.
You know, he's that balance. So I guess, Bane pushed Batman over the edge, obviously breaking his back and his mental state and all that stuff to just basically refocus, which is cool because earlier when I was talking about, like, the whole Bane hunting him down, in this movie, instead of Bane really breaking down Batman already really broke down himself. He was so out of shape. He was so fucked up. He was so just emotionally drained when he put that costume back on. Yeah, he did the cool scene with chasing Bane and all that, but when he had to fight, he was just not ready.
And Tom Hardy knows how to punch. You see that in Warrior.
Oh,
there's
my God.
One particular – yeah, we both do. And you see during the final scene in particular, there's this one spot where Batman's kind of pushed up against a pillar. Tom Hardy throws two shots to the body and then one to the other side of the face. Yeah. They look so good and so real, and they're done so fast. You're like, yeah, Batman, you need to retire, bro. You can't handle this.
That dude would just beat the hell out of you if he got you in that corner.
But he was like, Bane was not freakishly big. He was a human who was ripped, who had, in the words of one of our associates, Joseph Mastretta, a barrel chest.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like he was never like enormous. Like one thing about Arkham, in terms of Arkham Asylum and Arkham City, was annoying is how Bane was drawn.
He was comically huge?
Yeah, just ridiculous. Like it's not necessary. It's like, no, Bane's a guy. He's ripped to shreds and he's incredibly strong and – obviously, the serum thing, they didn't use that. They didn't need to. But Nolan's Bane is just incredibly smart and powerful and tough. But he was a League of Shadows fighter and knows what the hell he's doing. And is just strong without having to look like a monster. He's a monster because of what he does and because of the mask he wears. Other than that, he's just as human as everybody else.
Right, and they tell that in the story where basically you see Tali revealed and you see him protect Tali. You see him getting like beaten the hell up by the rest of the prison, and he's all scarred up, and you know, Ra's al Ghul doesn't want to deal with it. He's like, ugh, look at this guy. What the hell am I gonna do with this? So,
but damn, you kind of messed up, bro.
I say, before we go back to the ending and how we feel about it, I say first, big props to Hines Ward, Ryan Clark, the offensive line of the Pittsburgh Steelers, and miscellaneous people here and there, huh?
Yeah,
and their terrible towels of the Gotham Rogues, huh?
Yeah. And my fantasy team has come to life.
My Saturday Night Live team that was better than yours last time recorded, huh?
There was somebody sitting next to me in the theater wearing a Gotham Rogues shirt.
Nice.
It has like the Rogues logo on the front, and then on the back it says Nolan, and underneath that it says 08. Under Armour is selling official Gotham Rogues football jerseys for $200. They sponsored Batman. So... those are available, which is interesting. Every time I saw the trailer and saw the football scene, I felt like it was out of place. And it looked like it was too bright. There's too many colors compared to this Batman universe that we've come to know over the past 7 years that no one has crafted. And the program director down in Nashville at The Zone got to see a sneak preview the night before me, and he didn't want to spoil it for me. He wanted my opinion. He's actually going to be listening to this. So welcome, Brad. Hope you're digging it. But
is he digging it?
Yeah. He
just want to make sure.
I asked him, I said, the football scene is the only thing I've ever been kind of worried about because it just didn't feel Nolan-ish to me. He goes, trust me, it's well done. It's placed where it should be, and it doesn't feel out of place. It's done quickly, but it's done for effect. And then when I was watching it, when you have gone through all this action and incredibly loud action in a lot of cases, when they get to this scene and it goes dead quiet and all you hear is that child, I suddenly got it. I'm like, okay, it's creepy. No, this is absolutely beautiful.
It's creepy also.
Yeah,
man.
It is. It's terrifying.
It's so tense. Yeah.
Yeah. Again, emotional investment. And hey, props to Richard Alpert for showing back up as mayor for a couple seconds.
With his eyeshadows and everything, eyeliner. Which, by the way, you were the mayor in the second movie, and you're mayor in this one, so you got to think more than 8 years past, how the hell are you still the mayor in this corrupt town? All right, that being said, I thought to me it was brilliant also how he wasn't just Bane under the sewers. He was under the sewers in a specific spot for reasons that fleshed out and basically showed, oh, we were under Wayne Enterprises to steal his shit that we knew they had the whole time.
Again, it was expressing as clearly as it could just how – I don't want to use brilliant again because we've used it too much.
Amazing, fantastic.
What a genius Bane is as a character in terms of his actual mental faculties. Everything was planned out. Everything was meticulous. It wasn't like, you know, the Joker's always talking about, I just do things, not Bane. Bane planned this thing out for months.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird because when you see the film, it feels like everything takes place in 2 or 3 days. No, Batman was down in that prison or down in the deal for months. They were running with military rule in Gotham for a long period of time. A lot longer than it feels like when you're actually watching it. But when you really hear, you pay attention to the dialogue towards it, it's like they dealt with some shit for a long time.
Do you think at the end, when Talia was revealed, do you think it cheapened Bane a little bit?
Well, it kind of made him feel like he was being used. It made it look like he was sort of being used by her and being used by Roz. But no, I don't think so, because I think Bane was doing what Bane was going to do. Mm-hmm. Bane was still his own man. He was just benefiting somebody else. I think they were kind of using each other to some extent. But had it not been revealed, it would have been fine. But no, I don't think it felt it cheapened him because we got so much dialogue from Tom Hardy expressing what he was doing and what his motivations were that it all just kind of played in. Okay, they were in it together, and they're both important characters in the Batman universe.
What about the weakness with the mask? I thought that was a little – to me, like if I was Batman, I would think in my head like, why is that mask on? What would happen if I knocked that off? That would be my first like mind thought. I don't know.
Another brilliant Tom Hardy line was so if I took that mask off, would it kill you? It would be incredibly painful for you. Like you just go off on him, whatever. It's just that voice. People, I'll try to do that voice for the end of my life and until the end of time, and it's just not possible.
Hopefully, it'll be like your meat wad, but we'll leave that there.
Oh,
At least he didn't sound like Tim the Bear. Like it would be. Oh, I can't even do Tim the Bear with Bane right now. But I mean, it would be incredibly painful for you. I mean, come on, man.
Yeah. Nolan tells all three of his stories without putting the title screen at the beginning. The first time you see the title is the logo at the very end, in complete darkness, as the credits are about to roll. Like everything just felt so right from the very beginning. And then we get to this last 20 minutes, 25 minutes, and I can't tell you. I guess I read from a couple of headlines that just popped up on Facebook or Twitter that I couldn't avoid that some of the negative critiques, I think Rotten Tomatoes has it at 87% is what I heard.
Right.
I'm fine with that. Is that people said the ending was weak. I just don't understand that. I mean, everybody's entitled to their own opinion. I love the ending. Loved it. I was so happy with all of it. I mean, the idea that the bat showed up and just kind of flew over right before that scene, and that's when the police were like, oh, yeah, we got it. And then they took off, and this big confrontation happens. It's not, like, completely overblown or overshot. It's just a big mob fight between good and anarchy. And then when you get to these final reveals, the last – pretty much from the moment that Bane gets kicked into the bank and we're getting this last scene or into City Hall, And that's when the Talia thing happens. It's just 10 minutes of pure reveals about what's going to happen. And then you get the whole scene with him taking the bomb, the nuclear bomb, away from Gotham. Was there any part of you at all when that bomb exploded that actually thought he was indeed dead?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was like, wow, maybe, because maybe I thought he wanted to go out again. We've used this to death. He wanted to go out the symbol. He wanted to go out the, you know, the opposite of what he went out as in the second movie. He went out in the second movie as a vigilante voluntarily to hide and to do good for the city. This time around, I was like, to do both. And at the same time, like, you know what? I got to be selfish on this one. I have to take my life on this. I thought he was going to do that. I really did. I thought, like, somehow or another, it would bring back Blake as, like, a Nightwing-ish Robin thing on his own.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, because there was the moment just before all that goes down when Catwoman says, you don't owe these people anything. You've given them everything. And he says, not everything, not yet. And you're like, well, the only thing he hasn't given them is his life.
Right.
So when he takes that thing off and the way the music kind of really changes, it just feels like, okay, he's actually going to die here. But when it turns out that's not the case, he was still a symbol because he still died. In Gotham, he is the martyr that Harvey Dent was revealed not to be.
Right.
And the statue, I want that statue, by the way. It'd go with my Batman statue I already have, the $30 one from Walmart.
There's better ones you can get.
Yeah, I know. But
come on, admit it. You spray paint that one you have black, that'd be awesome.
This is obviously, comics are told and retold, and you said that's one of the reasons you don't buy them. Look, it's these people's interpretations of what's happening. This is Nolan's Batman story. There's somebody I read on Facebook that just some friend of mine that said something like, well, no Batman writer would ever do this. I think this ending was terrible. And I was like, no, this is Nolan's ending, but I don't think there's any reason to dislike this at all. The only thing that I started to wonder is, what if there was a Robin movie with Levitt? I'm not saying there will be. I'm about positive there won't be. But
if it comes out in the next 2 to 3 years, people will see it.
I would see it anytime. Not just because I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but because they made Robin matter.
Right.
Nolan spent a good part of that movie in the background making Robin matter.
Here's the thing to kind of say what you're saying. There's always going to be, in any fashion or form, whether it be this movie, comics, sports, TV, media, there will always be haters who are going to hate. Okay, we like, for instance, LeBron James. LeBron James got his first ring, finally, last month. Good for him. Congratulations. People will still hate LeBron James to the day they die.
No doubt.
No matter if it's for the Cleveland thing or they just don't like him because they're Jordan fans, or they think Kobe's better. It doesn't fucking matter. LeBron James can get 8 rings. People will hate him no matter what because that's what people are. Tom Brady, 4-time Super Bowl champion. People hate him. Does he give people a bunch of reason? No. He really doesn't on the media side. He doesn't say anything wrong. He doesn't do anything bad. He doesn't beat his wife. But people hate him because he is just Tom Brady. People are going to hate this movie. They're going to hate it because it's not what they wanted.
And well, there's also the people that will hate it just to hear themselves talk.
Exactly. Like, I fucking went to see Batman Begins back, you know, in 2005 when the guy behind me, some jackass teenager, goes, I don't think it was good as the first one. I'm like, fuck you, man. Really? You can't even buy a cigarette. Huh?
Wasn't that at the Dark Knight? I think you've told me that story
before. No, that was Batman Begins. I remember who I was with when that happened.
Weirdly enough, Tiger was with me when I saw Batman Begins. He wasn't with me, but he sat in front of us. It was him and Adam and me and Tyler and Tool. That saw it. Was interesting. Of course, our buddy Tyler was in this film.
Yep.
Was in The Dark Knight Rises.
Matthew Tyler Gerber. Look for him on the right side somewhere.
Superstar in the making with that 6 seconds of screen time. Actually, six is generous. More like three and a half. But
with his chipmunk face, I'm sure he had.
Yeah. But, all right. So we've dissected it, and we could go into even more detail, and I'm sure we will off this podcast. But let's get to the ending.
Yeah, we're approaching almost 2 hours here, so let's wrap it up.
We'll get the Talia reveal. When the knife goes in, you kind of see the
His face was so funny to me. Yeah. He's just like that. What the hell is this?
What? It's just kind of
like, I thought you... I thought you fixed that problem in the second movie when you were like, I need better armor. But I guess I remember They made it better for dog bites, not for a knife, because I think even Lucia was like, if you get stabbed directly, it'd be a problem.
Say it's a bullet, but not a knife.
Right.
But you get that, and then again, the last classic Tom Hardy line with the whole, you realize I have to kill you now.
Right. Like,
and the whole time that he's just kind of on the ground while Talia is explaining what really has gone on and what their history is and everything else.
I was like, why is he giving up fighting? I mean, I know he's getting stabbed right now, but...
Yeah, just they're all just kind of chilling to have this moment together. And then, of course, the bomb doesn't go off because, and again, they do a really good job of Gordon trying to track down the bomb.
Right.
And just all of those scenes, and it's just like, you know he's going to make it.
It shows his importance to the whole mythology and to the movies, because he served a purpose. Everyone in this movie had a role for a reason. They're not just there to be there. And that's the thing about these superhero movies that fucking pisses me off, that they wanted to just throw in characters just to be there, which can work at times, because like in Batman Begins, Zaz, a minor villain in Batman mythology, is in the movie. Well, for a brief second, he's just there to be there for those who like really know Batman and go, oh, shit, that's cool. But he's not there just to fucking be there to overtake the film and just a huge cameo appearance from like a big celebrity. No, he's just there to be there. But in this movie, everyone served a purpose. Daggett served a purpose. You know, Foley served a purpose because he was a symbol of like regret in a sense.
And Nolan's Gordon doesn't just sit around.
Or he's not some overnight fat guy from Tim Burton's.
Yeah, but he doesn't just put up a bat symbol and wait for everybody to do stuff. He's all over it himself.
Right, exactly.
He helped save the city.
I don't know. I just I cannot go on a tangent enough how, to me, everyone, this whole cast.
Oh, absolutely.
Just Blake to Talia, to Catwoman. There was no one that I would say miscast. Even Thomas Lennon. He wasn't miscast at all. Nope. I'll take Dangle in that movie for 30 seconds. That's cool with me. I'm okay with that.
Oh, my goodness.
What?
Nothing. Nothing at all.
He's a breakout star. You know it.
So the bat takes the bomb out to sea. It blows up. The whole theater's wondering, is he dead? Then it goes immediately to his eulogy being given by Gordon, kind of similar, ominously, to the way he was talking after Harvey Dent.
Private ceremony.
Yeah, exactly. And you see from behind Alfred's back. And here's a real intricate thing that I thought the first time was actually the same thing, and then I found out when I was watching the second time that I was making two sounds mix. There's a moment when you see everybody else is going through the gate after the eulogy, like after it's all done, and Alfred's still standing there. And he moves his head at the same time that the gate actually moves. And it sounds like he's crying, but it's actually the gate opening. You can hear a creak of the gate, but it sounds like it's Alfred breaking up. And Michael Caine moves his head at the same time, both times. When I was watching the second time, I realized it was the gate. I'm like, I don't know if that's intentional or just lucky. But it just works out. And then the whole I failed you, and that's when I had to try and fight back my own tears. That whole, like, moment or whatever. But
I was
pretty much
really hoping...
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was really hoping on the Tombstone they weren't going to put R.I.P. Bruce Wayne. I'm like,
yeah,
oh.
Me too. And then pretty much from that moment on, it's just reveal after reveal after reveal. It's like, all right, well, we're going to get your ending now. It's like,
I love that he told him that Batman told Gordon in the end who he was in that little line.
That was the other thing I wanted to get to is in Nolan's Batman, Bruce Wayne is not trying to hide this from anybody. He's trying to protect people. They keep making the point that you wear the mask to protect those you care about.
Right,
in the final moments, he lets Gordon know in a way that only Gordon would know. And he already knows that Selina found out during the Bane confrontation. And he knows that John Blake already knew it.
It's so, almost in a way that he's thanking him, though.
Yeah, basically in his own way. He's like, he basically said, he almost alluded to the fact that Gordon saved him as a kid by reminding him that hope still exists. And then we get that one, that nice 5-second flashback to Batman Begins when he puts the coat on him.
It's a good flip because you remember in the end of Batman Begins, he's like, you know, I never got a chance to thank you.
And you'll never have to.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of flipped of like, now it's not Gordon thanking him for like, hey, thanks for taking the bomb away. No, it's like, thanks for making me who I am. I gotta go do this shit, by the way, so I'll see you later.
And then, obviously, he's already in the sky and you see Bruce Wayne?
Yeah.
Kane?
But that to me was good. And the thing is like, I normally don't like it when in the past Batman movies, like, somehow or another, somebody always finds out who the hell he is. You know, like in Tim Burton's first Batman, you know, Vicki Vale finds out.
Right.
And she, you know, mums it, mums a word, doesn't tell anybody, and that's it. You don't see her anymore. In the second one, you find out that, you know, the Penguin and Christopher Walken find out when he reveals the mask with Selina.
Right.
Which Anne Hathaway blows Michelle Pfeiffer's character by far.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's not annoying to watch. You're like, meow.
She's not just some sex symbol. Really at all. She's just sexy and hot, and you know she's hot, but that's not what she's doing at all. And they show depth of character, especially the stuff in the bar. The bar scene's my favorite scene with her. When she pulls the Peter Parker move from The Amazing Spider-Man and fake cries.
Right.
And just all of the stuff that goes into it. It's like, all right, very good representation of Catwoman. Not overused. Used to continue to draw the story forward. Another thing Nolan has not done is overdone it with romance. You know that Bruce loved Rachel Dawes, but it's not beat over the head. Like, there's so many superhero movies where it's the superhero and the girl that he loves, and that's everything.
Right.
And that's not the way Nolan uses these characters because, yes, love exists in life, but that's not, in large part, what drives Bruce Wayne and what drove Batman for 70 years in the comics. And Nolan tells his own story where Batman is more concerned with just driving out evil and preserving hope for the people of Gotham than anything else. And he cares about these women, and it doesn't change anything. When Bruce sleeps with what inevitably turns out to be Talia, that makes more sense if you know the comics and know that the two of them had that relationship.
Well, I like to – well, I mean, we're back with the identity thing. We'll get Batman Forever, Chase Meridian finds out, Chris O'Donnell finds out.
Right.
Batman and Robin, Alicia Silverstone finds out, and then I think – I can't remember if Poison Ivy finds out before she dies, but Riddler figures that out in Batman Forever also, and Tommy Lee Jones, the Two-Face, finds out. So, like, throughout all these movies in the past, there's just – and then obviously Rachel Dawes in the first Batman Begins finds out when, you know, he's like –
Well, he tells her, though.
Yeah, he's like, it's not who I am underneath. It's what I do that defines me.
He only – he tells him in scenes that we've already seen. Every time somebody figures it out in a Nolan film, it's from – some piece of dialogue that's already been said so that nobody else understands it, and they never figured it out by themselves, but Bruce has no problem with them understanding who he is and why he acts like this douchebag playboy all the time.
So I've always said, like, man, like, for Batman to have a secret identity, he sure does tell a lot of fucking people in these movies.
Yeah.
But with this last movie, with Blake finding out on his own, which is, again, great, and, you know, Hathaway finding out the way she did, Hardy finding out the way he did, Oldman finding out the way he did at the very end and was like, you know what? I got no problem with this. I'm good. I'm on board. I'll drive the train. I'll drive the bandwagon. Let's go.
Right.
So, I can't. And it's me being a fanboy, but I really just, there's nothing in this movie I want to break apart.
Me either. I can't nitpick a single thing I didn't like. Not a single thing. And then, again, from the way that they execute the last 5 minutes with the cafe scene, the look on Bruce's face with the longer hair on vacation with Anne Hathaway, both of them having shed their previous lives, the look that Michael Caine gives him when he finally gets his wish, that Bruce is happy and fulfilled and has moved on. And then you see the beginnings of the next chapter with Levitt having the directions to the Batcave, spelunking in, and then just kind of walking up. And when that platform starts to rise and you hear Hans Zimmer's major, the biggest note that he always uses in these films, start to hit, and you see the platform start to rise, and you realize, all right, we're done here. This is going to be it, because everything's going dark as the platform's going up. When the first doom hits and you see the Dark Knight Rises hit the screen, you're like, all right, well, that was as good as you'll ever see a film be. And in terms of an ending, you'll never see anything better than that. Not in my opinion. It's unbelievable.
I was kind of glad also, because in my head, when I knew what was going on in the last few seconds, like, I really hope there's not a costume waiting already with an R or a big blue, you know, bat wing on it. Just be like, oh, God, that just looks so weird in this universe that Nolan's created. I don't want to see, like, I want to see Robin, obviously, but I don't want to see it now, because it takes away a little bit.
So, right. Like, you never see Robin. You know he's Robin, but he's wearing plain clothes. He's a normal human being, and it's like the same way that Bruce Wayne didn't just all of a sudden find a bat costume. It came about in Nolan's universe through his own fear of bats and the way that they developed it, and the fact that a lot of the pieces were already a part of Wayne Enterprises that Lucius Fox showed him. It's like, no, Robin doesn't have a suit. He's probably looking towards getting a mask based on what Bruce and what Batman had already told him, but he's still John Blake. He's, well, I guess he's Robin John Blake now or whatever, but it's, there's no need to show him in the suit because it's all just kind of left up to your imagination when the black hits and the Dark Knight Rises hits the screen that you realize what's going to happen, but it's left up to you to figure it out unless Warner Brothers gets on their knees and just offers Chris Nolan $300 trillion to come back and direct a Robin film.
Which is funny because at the end when he gets the guys out of the tunnel, he gives them the little bomb. He's like, hey, click this, wait 5 seconds and throw it. I'm like, why did he just do that? Let me say, oh, well, he just taught him how to use his equipment.
Right, pretty much.
So the whole Bane not being the son of Ra's al Ghul thing, glad that flipped around that revelation because it fucked with me when I thought about it. I was like, they never did say son or boy or, you know, whatever to allude that it was a boy the whole time. They always said child.
Right.
This child of the prison. I was like, fuck. I felt disappointed in myself a little bit. But again, it was just Nolan being deceptive in the storytelling because you're so engrossed in everything else going on in the movie, you just kind of go with what he says.
Like nobody thought going in they were going to let Batman die because that just doesn't happen in film. Nolan had some tricks up his sleeve and he didn't want to give anything away. So he cryptically tells this one story while planning to surprise those that aren't paying close enough attention with two or three really nice pieces of fan service at the end. And if you had already figured out, which I think probably, I don't know, maybe I'm giving the world too much credit, but I'd say at least half the people watching it figure out it's going to be Robin long before it becomes blatantly obvious. But for those people that didn't, that's a really nice moment when they're like, oh my God, it's Robin. You know, it's just like, and again, it's never beat over the head. It's like you get to see, again, I think that the real triumph of this film is that they took a character that has largely been a joke and even led to Robert Smigel developing the ambiguously gay duo for Saturday Night Live and gave us an origin story of this guy who becomes Robin and why it matters and why this guy's pretty awesome because they just show him basically being incredibly smart, finding a way to get messages to the cops when they're underground. When it's time to fight, he's able to fight.
And he never gives up.
No.
He never gives up hope.
Relentless. Complete relentless hope and relentless belief in what Batman represents and what it means. And it's just like, man, that's the first – that there will never be a better Robin personified than that because that completely, to me, vindicates the character as a whole. That is just – you did not go into The Dark Knight Rises expecting to see – the origin of Robin taking place in front of your eyes. And that is just, to me, that really makes this film incredibly special.
Let me ask you this. How long would you say would be appropriate, or if at all, and I guess if you want to wrap it up on this note, unless you got something else, how long, if possible, would you say it would take to even remotely come close to even wanting to reboot the Batman franchise? Let's not count Justice League movie that may or may not happen in 3 years. Leave that alone. But, in which I'm sure people will be confused, but like, they didn't have no Christian Bale in that one. It's called trademarks and contracts, people. Leave it alone.
Okay. Yeah.
They never collide. Anyway, how long would you think would be appropriate, if at all, they should be a reboot to this?
I'd love to say not at all, but I would say at least 50 years. I'm serious. I mean, what are you going to do? Why would you do that? I know that there's so much money in the franchise and that they'll try and do it again in 15 years or maybe even less. I don't know. Maybe I'm giving, again, the world too much credit. But I think that the stanza is told. If you want to go back and start trying to do another cartoon that's really great or whatever like that, knock yourself out. But in my opinion,
they already got one in the works.
Yeah, but here's the thing. You've already got the best cartoon-related animated series of all time. Done. In the can, 4 seasons, available for DVD right now. You've got a secondary franchise that a lot of people liked in Batman Beyond. Not necessarily everybody, but a lot of people. You have some successful animated films, Mask of the Phantasm.
Just the property of Batman.
Return
of
the Joker. Exactly. And now you've had Christopher Nolan give you a trilogy that is going to make you money forever. When they release that trilogy special edition blowout Blu-ray set in 15 years or 10 years, that's what you do. Release something special based on what's already been done. There's no director at all that is going to be able to take this franchise and do with it what Christopher Nolan just did with it, because, again, there's no Ewoks, and there's not 2 minutes worth of stuff that we could go back and say, we wish they had done this. We are sitting here, and we have talked now about this film for over an hour, and in that time, we've gotten to the end of it and said, there is not a single thing in this film that we would have liked to have seen done differently.
Now, granted, we are two people now. There are people who will say stuff. So those people, there are, I would say, very few people that would want to see either a reboot or something else other than with that. Because, again, we mentioned people who didn't like the movie or wanted Poison Ivy or who said that this is Nolan's weakest work of all, whatever. But
I think
they're insane. Well, those people would be ridiculed, sure enough, once the vast majority come out.
The very last question was asked to me when they called me for the radio interview yesterday about the film was Paul Kaharsky said, would you be willing to give people their money back after giving this review of the film if they didn't like it? I said, absolutely, provided with the addendum that I'd never have to speak to them again afterwards. Because it's like, you're entitled to your opinion. I just don't see how you can't like this. This is a 2-hour and 45-minute movie where there is not a single thing in it that I didn't want to happen. It's just like, it's great scene after great scene after great scene. The second film in particular feels like it's on a train the entire time. Hans Zimmer's score is pounding 85% of the time in the background. The first half of this film is a lot more slowed down. And then the second half is more like The Dark Knight was in terms of the action pieces. But it's I don't think it's poorly paced at all. I think it's meticulously paced and, to me, done flawlessly. I just have nothing bad to say about it. I just can't wait to see it again. That's my opinion.
The thing that gets me, and I'm thinking about it now, when you say 50 years, I can actually see that as a possibility. Look at the last Superman movie. It was like 84, 85, Quest for Peace. It took 30 years for them. Well, no, I'm sorry, 20 years. I apologize. I can't do math right now in my head. Because it was, 2006, 2007?
Yeah, and those films were bad that it was rebooting.
Yeah.
These are great films.
It took 20 years for a new Superman franchise. And when they redid that, it was shitty. They've already rebooted the reboot within 5 years.
And they rebooted it because those other films were bad and they wanted to try and fix it and try to tell a new story. There was still stuff to untap. There's nothing to tap here. The films are perfect. That's why I say 50 years, because if you do anything, it's just not going to be as good. It's like, it might still be a great movie, but it's not going to be The Dark Knight. It's not going to be Batman Begins, and it's damn sure not going to be The Dark Knight Rises. It's just no way.
I would say this. In the vast future, if and when there is ever another Batman movie, let's throw out some villains we would want to see other than the ones we've already seen or the obvious ones. I would love to see Clayface.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
It would never fit in Nolan's universe, but
it would almost have to be R-rated if you told the right story.
Yeah.
So would Mad Hatter, but definitely Clayface. But if they could do it right to where the CGI looked right, and you would think in 50 years they'd have something that looks really good.
King Tut?
Yeah, exactly. Poison Ivy's never been one of my favorite villains. I just don't care, quite frankly. The Joker they would do again. I mean, we know they would do that again.
I want to see Joker with Harley, though. I think that's a big thing.
Harley is untapped. Harley is something they could do. Harley would have shown up in this film had Heath Ledger not died, probably.
Right.
Penguin is still kind of campy, but the actual Oswald Cobblepot character from the comics and from the animated series, they could do that if they did it right. I mean, we're not talking Danny DeVito here or something like that, but they could obviously do the Riddler again if they wanted to. But in terms of people that have never been done in film, I think Clayface is probably the top of that list. I'm trying to think if we're missing anybody. Killer Croc would just feel like the Lizard from Spider-Man.
If you did this, what if you did the story arc of, let's say it's a 3-part movie, introduce Robin in the first one, and then the second one he goes I don't know. No, that wouldn't work. I was gonna say somehow Jason Todd-ish do the Red Hood storyline.
I thought you might be going there to have like the kind of confrontation between all the characters.
Right.
And you could do it, but I think that the people would have to be really educated on the story to not be lost watching that.
Right.
I guess. It would kind of have like a Mission Impossible 1 feeling to 90% of the country, mm-hmm. where it's hard to follow if you're not really paying close attention. But Batman franchise, to do that, you'd have to establish it a lot early on to do it. I'd like to see it. You'd like to see it. I'm just afraid a lot of people in the country would be lost trying to understand what was going on. I'm trying to think if there's anybody else at all. Mr. Freeze is dead. Forever.
Aw.
I just don't think that's a really hokey character.
Starting like to this, chill.
Yeah, yeah. It's the ice needs. Day. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to Are there any other villains?
Oh, there's tons, and you got a calendar, man.
Yeah, that's true. You could just do the long Halloween.
Do Zazz.
I mean, Batman's obviously not going anywhere. The Dark Knight Returns is the next animated property that's coming out for DC Animated. Frank Miller's iconic story, which you and right. I both love. And which, you know, early on in The Dark Knight, the second Nolan film, that's kind of Dark Knight Returns-ish with the three different Batmans, one with a gun, and all that kind of stuff. That's all kind of ripped from what The Dark Knight Returns is. But in terms of like other villains that they could do, I don't know. I think there's more that could be done with Roz if you wanted to go back and tell that story again in 50 years.
The Black,
and do it differently. Black Mask.
Yeah. Yeah.
I get. Oh, you know who we're forgetting about? Hush. That's what they need to do. If you do it in 50 years, you do Hush.
That's what's. It's, well, yeah.
Or if you do a Robin movie, do Hush.
Hush is so complicated, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Which we can go all day on Batman villains. That's just a whole other podcast down the road. But
suffice to say, this movie is incredible.
Yeah, you could do a movie about Catwoman's hooker friend that was in the movie.
Yeah, the blonde.
Yeah.
No.
Why not? She was all there. Juno Temple, I think her name was.
Yeah.
Played Jin. The brand character of Jin. Have a movie about Jin. Hooking.
I'd rather have a movie about Alfred being a butler for somebody else. I was thinking about, because of the Bane voice and the mask, if I wrote sketch comedy or anything like that, I would do like Bane eating breakfast. Like at home in the suburbs. Like having a conversation with like a maid.
Or like this.
Oh, honey, not Cheerios again.
Well, he's in the shower, and like before he takes off the mask, like it smells like a, you know, when like someone has a cast on their foot and it just reeks. His wife's like, "Oh my god!"
He like takes the mask off and she just passes out.
It's like flies under his breath and shit like that. Awful. Well, he's got tan lines on his head because of the fucking way the mask like shows the back of his head.
Oh my goodness! Well. Again, I don't want to call it the best movie of all time because I'm not far enough away from having seen it to not be just caught up and trapped in the moment. But it's already on the short list, and I can't help myself there. It's just extraordinary in every way. And I don't think that you and I could have dreamed for a better conclusion to this saga than what actually showed up on screen.
Actually, the only thing I was dreaming of was I was wishing at the very end that Captain Atom was going to come in and just absorb the nuclear bomb for him.
That would have surprised everybody.
But like what? The theater, I got this, guys.
You've been walking out of the theater like, hey, did you watch Batman? Are you a big comic fan? Who the hell was that in the end of the movie? Because they didn't even explain it.
What the hell was Captain Planet doing in the movie?
I want to thank Warner Brothers and whoever was responsible, DC, for those badass posters that they gave out to all the people that went to the very first IMAX screens across the country, because that poster is awesome, and I can't wait to get that bad boy framed. Mm. It's a black and white. Have you seen the picture?
No.
Oh, you find it online. It's a black and white poster that just has Bane on it, and it's just his face. The entire poster is his face.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
It says 1201 on the bottom. And the Bat logo is right underneath that, and it says IMAX. But, yeah, that was a nice bonus. And the theater, again, and another intelligent thing, greatest theater I've ever been in my life, and one of the reasons why is because it's reserved seating. So I knew where I was going to sit, and there were no lines. There were no lines anywhere except in concessions because everybody already had their seat. People were walking in, you know, 5 minutes before the theater, before the film started, because there was no reason not to. And that to me is something that every theater in this country should adopt, because one of the things that's just completely unnecessary at this time when we have technology and everything, when you buy concert tickets, when you buy anything, you buy a seat. Why not buy a movie seat? It would eliminate the lines. And you were talking about the line at Simpsonville last night, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, there'd be no need to get there 3 hours early. It would eliminate so much of the nonsense that goes on in the theater going experience for you to just have J14 and that's it. If you need to go to the bathroom, you've got J14. If you need to get a drink 2 minutes before the movie starts, you've got J14. You don't have to save a seat for anybody because your tickets are already bought for those seats. To me, it just makes way too much sense. And I'd never even thought about it until I went to this theater. And I'm like, why doesn't everybody do this? Why would you not do this? I just don't understand why it's not more widely used than it is. But I thought it was brilliant.
I think the only thing that I would say to counter the argument would be like if you – let's say like for instance, I had to buy my tickets about 12 hours in advance of this movie just to be safe. You come into the complications of, like, let's say people who do concerts. And like, for instance, I bought recently tickets to The Lion King off of Craigslist, who happen to have phenomenal seats. Third row from the orchestra pit right in the middle. That was the luckiest thing I ever gotten and worked out a deal with this guy.
Right.
But let's say you want to go to the show, you buy tickets, and you're in, like, the far left, the far right side, up in a corner you normally would never sit in your life. But you're stuck with it because it's either this or you go to another show or you wait another day. But you really, really want to go see this movie this fucking time, this fucking moment now, because it's the only time you can fucking work in your schedule to go see this. That's where I see a flaw in that whole thing.
All right. I mean, I understand that argument. But
the experience. No, I'm all for you with the experience.
I think it's a good thing. It just means you have to be able to plan ahead.
And most people can't.
I mean, I bought my tickets to both the shows I saw 6 weeks ago. So...
Nerd.
Yeah, no, I've got no problem. I'll be a card carrying nerd if it means that I get to wax poetic about the Dark Knight Rises. But to conclude this now over 2 hour conversation, if you have not seen the Dark Knight Rises, we apologize. You should not be listening to this right now.
If you have not seen the Dark Knight Rises, like in Caesar's already said, what the fuck is wrong with you people?
Yeah, that movie's incredible. But I will be watching it for a third time on Monday, and I'm sure you'll be watching it again tomorrow, probably, or soon. And I imagine, I remember The Dark Knight came out December 9th or December 13th on Blu-ray and DVD. I would believe that this one will come out probably 2-3 weeks before Christmas, and it'll be a situation where I'll be pre-ordering that bad boy, because I have a feeling that's not going to be the easiest thing to find going around Christmas time, and I don't even want to play around with it, because... as I did with The Dark Knight, it might even be worse this time. I don't think that once I get that film in my presence that I won't be able to continuously watch it for a long, long, long time. But that's the best $9 – well, for me it was $17 a ticket that you could spend to watch a movie. And again, I said that this film and what has come out this year could beat what happened in 2009. I've been wrong every time. It's 2008 when all that stuff was brilliant and came out. This has definitely done it. The Avengers was outstanding in every way. We've already done a long podcast on that. Amazing Spider-Man was fabulous. And Dark Knight Rises is as good a film as you'll ever watch in any medium. And my final question to you as we say sayonara here is, do you think that there is Academy Award potential coming for this film?
For the film, maybe, but superhero movies always get snubbed. Hans Zimmer will probably definitely get something for his musical work.
Well,
Nolan, maybe. Yeah, but I'm saying, you're talking about as the movie, though.
Well, I'm talking about people in it or anything associated with it from a...
People, I'm sure, are going to get nominated, but as far as actually winning, no. Because just that's always, to me, how the Academy works. They don't give the superhero movies, except for, I mean, if you want to categorize Lord of the Rings
as a sci-fi... I believe that the film and Nolan will get nominated.
Oh, yeah, nominated, but will
I'm
it
talking
win?
About nominated. Because The Dark Knight got completely snubbed, except for Ledger. And I think that this film will get the nomination that The Dark Knight didn't get. And I think that Nolan was directed for, or was nominated for Inception, was passed over for The Dark Knight.
Right.
And I think that he will get nominated for that, and that screenplay, the original screenplay that they wrote, the story that they wrote, will probably also get nominated. And if it doesn't, we will riot.
Mm.
So there you go, folks. CTR done. It's now 10 o'clock here in the Central Time Zone. That means it's 11 where Andy is, and we started this bad boy about 2.5 hours ago, and then we started recording about 2 hours and 15 minutes ago. So we could go 2 hours and 45 minutes to match the length of the film, but quite frankly, I don't think we're quite as talented as Nolan and company.
That, and we don't want to annoy our fans to drag them in. Make them listen to all this.
Exactly.
So real quick, yes. we never gave the official props to our unofficial sponsor, which they've probably never heard of. But I'm also going to give props to Borderlands of Greenville, South Carolina, at 1434 Lawrence Road at 864-235-3488. Give them a call. Very professional, very nice service. One of the longest running comic stores in this area since I was a little kid that I can far back as remember. But they've expanded recently. They cater to all kinds of things. Give them a shout, look them up. They got a nice website. They don't have a gross email, so give them a look. It's good times. Any final words before I do our little outro?
No. I'm just so happy that film was as good as
put the boner away.
It would be. It's too late.
The bad boner. All right. Well, from myself, Andrew Van, in Simpsonville / Greenville, South Carolina, with my co-host, Jason Martin. You can find him at /JMart100 on Facebook, Twitter, and you don't have a Pinterest yet, but you have other stuff, I'm sure. If you want, for Chits and Giggles, ladies and gentlemen, I think we both still have Google Plus, but if you use that, good for you. Last update was last year at some point. Mine is /AVAN360 at Facebook, Twitter, and on Pinterest. Find me there. Give me some shouts. Give us some shouts. Email us at CTRpod, not podcast. Someone else has that, like bastards, at CTRpod@gmail.com, or write us messages, tweets, texts, whatever you know how to get to us. Give us some ideas. What do you want to talk about? Let us know what you think. Find us on iTunes. Find us at CTR.podomatic.com, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. Or, of course, on iTunes.
On iTunes, all for free. You fuckers don't pay us a damn thing.
We're not going to pay for it, but go watch that movie again.
Yeah, exactly. Do yourself a favor as an American. No, I'm kidding. Just go see the movie. Anyway, from both of us at CTR, Survival, Total Recall, we out.